there, and welcome to the 245th episode of Radio Free Nintendo. This is Greg sitting in for Johnny temporarily, we hope.
I don't.
Dr. Metz is in transit at the minute. Hopefully he's going to be able to make it for later segments in the show.
Come on, freak May snowstorm.
But we are going to get underway here with James, who you just heard, and John is joining us as usual as well.
Rest in peace, Macho Man. Ooh, yeah!
Oh, yeah!
It just, you know, if anyone goes back and listens to that stinger with Johnny doing his impression, it wasn't that long ago. It's just got this really melancholy kind of tint to it
now. It's very sad now. It's like watching a John Candy movie, except those were never really funny.
Oh, you watch your mouth.
Oh, I just pissed off fan base that's over 30. Take that.
John Candy's a comedic genius.
And didn't he help the 49ers win the Super Bowl that once? When Joe said, isn't that John Candy? And that calmed everyone down before they put it in against the Bengals at the end.
That is true. He also owned the Toronto Argos when they won the Grey Cup. So there you go.
That's right.
Anyway, we will now.
It's already gone wrong. The episode's already terrible.
James, I am assigning this new business to you because apparently you don't have any games to talk about. So this was your new business, John Candy.
I've actually not played video games except for Perfect Dark at all this week. Unless you want to hear me talk about Chrome Hounds again. And I know you don't. So we're not going
oh, Chrome Hounds. What delicious reference that is.
And I know you don't. So we're not going to talk about it.
Yep, so just to be clear, we will be covering the multiplayer part of a Perfect Dark Retroactive discussion later on in the show. We certainly hope Johnny's going to be able to join us
also
for that.
Also known as Johnny and I get completely annihilated by bots while John stands there silent because his headphones died.
Oh, I feel so left out. I am looking forward to hearing about all this stuff. But John, you've been playing a somewhat related first-person shooter, haven't you?
Yeah, you know, I feel like, you know, I'm, again, late to the party with this one. GoldenEye for Wii, I picked it up. It was on sale at on Amazon for $20.
That's right. Well, we heard that on the show. Yeah. The seed was planted right here.
Yep. Well, you know, I mean, if people say that it's worth playing, I'll pick it up if it's cheap like that. The thing is, I never really saw it as the type of game that would drop to, you know, dirt cheap rock bottom prices. Like, I figured it'll probably just become one of the Nintendo Selects titles soon enough.
Except Nintendo never did select it.
The important thing about Nintendo Selects in the Western territories is that it's just first-party titles for now. And very specifically, it's like first-party titles that have sold well, but their sales have trailed off to a point where they feel like a discount release would do them good rather than, you know, some of the other ones that just keep bloody selling, you know, at full price.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, in Japan, that whole everybody's selection thing is exclusively third-party titles and is at least ostensibly based off how they're rated by people on the Nintendo channel.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, so it's completely different kind of program, even though they have similarly iffy red and gold packaging. Mm-hmm. But yeah, GoldenEye, I think, actually sold relatively well to start with, at least, but I mean, these days, if you keep your eye out, you'll probably find a good deal sooner or later.
Yeah, well, you know, so I picked it up, and I'm really impressed so far. I haven't played any of the online multiplayer, but I started off the campaign mode, and it's a really good-looking game. I mean, really much, much better looking than, you know, I mean, I haven't played The Conduit 2.
Much better looking than that game I haven't played.
Well, but, I mean, like, something like, compared to something like The Conduit, even compared to Black Ops. I mean, Black Ops wasn't really too impressive to me. I mean, I think it had a lot of features.
Right.
There's all kinds of different modes, and there's all kinds of stuff you could do, and I was actually really impressive, but graphically, it really wasn't that great looking a game. It looked fine. But definitely I was really impressed by GoldenEye. You know, I mean, Daniel Craig looks like Daniel Craig. And
which is why he's on your wall, right, John?
Which doesn't look like Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah, but, you know, exactly. I mean, well, you know, but he looks like it actually looks good, you know?
Unlike Pierce Brosnan, right?
I mean, it's not surprising if you played Dead Space Extraction and you saw the way the dialogue scenes transpire in that with the facial animations and the voice acting and all that. Euracom know what they're doing in that regard. We're pretty much better than anyone I could think of on Wii.
Yeah, and, you know, they really do a good job of, you know, kind of interspersing cutscenes but also kind of action within the cutscenes themselves. And You know, kind of things like if he rolls out of a truck or something that's just caught on fire, you know, it shows he puts his hands down on the ground and he, you know, pulls himself up and does all that kind of stuff, like little things where you're just like, wow, you know, it's kind of like cool. It's not just like you're straight. You aren't just a walking tank. Like, it actually kind of gives you some sort of idea that your character kind of exists in this world more so than just a floating gun, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
The only thing I didn't like, I found, and maybe you can adjust this, I haven't really played with the options very much, but, you know, turning,
yeah, there's a lot of options with bounding box stuff.
Yeah.
And indeed, what you can do is have separate tunings for, like, your standard view and then the aim down sights view.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. I found tinkering around with those really helped with the Wii Remote nunchuck configuration that I used a lot. Did you go that way or Pro?
Yeah, that's what I played. I haven't tried Classic Controller Pro. I just, you know, instinctively used the nunchuck and Wii Remote. So what I found was with the default settings is that you couldn't really turn very quickly. Like, you got the, you know, red circle with the strike through it, kind of
saying,
yeah,
when
that,
you're,
yeah,
outside the box kind of thing.
Yep.
Yeah, I found that a bit as well with the default controls, but obviously it's nice that they have the ability to tune them, you know, in quite fine detail.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it just seems kind of strange to me that the default setting is so kind of slow in that way. But I guess, you know, maybe they felt like, you know, if someone's not used to, like, precisely moving the cursor around, they might think that their field of vision would just, like, be, you know, all over the place if it was too sensitive.
Yeah.
And kept it pretty kind of boxed in for the default.
Yeah, like, I would think that they would have, like, it just seems like in every single one of these games that have this sort of Wiimote nunchuck control, even with, like, Killzone 3, I mean, there's so much tweaking involved. You would think that they would be able to, especially, like, during playtesting, that they would be able to kind of figure out, but yeah, so I played through the first area of the campaign. I was really impressed by the whole movie style intro, like where, you know, where he jumps off the dam, not to give a spoiler, but it's in the movie.
John, you bastard.
And then you get the song.
That really bizarro song at the start that's like
The retake of the Tina Turner song that accompanied the original film.
Yep.
It's a bit like a parody of a Bond film. I mean, there are like silhouettes of naked women turning into guns. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, no, but that's the thing, though. That's the way those movies are, though.
Thing about Bond films, they are verging on parodies a lot of the time. I think, yeah, that's probably chalk that one up to authenticity. But you know who actually wrote the GoldenEye song was Bono and the Edge from U2.
Yeah, I saw
that's
that.
That's why it sucks. Oh, okay.
Pretty bit of trivia there.
Yeah, no, I was actually really impressed by that whole opening. I was like, wow, this is actually like a Bond film. Like, the fact that they would go to that length.
This is all the worst from the Bond films.
Because usually I'm so used to playing, like, especially with first-person shooters, where companies will just, like, crap out a first-person shooter, and it'll be okay, but, you know, they'll cut corners here, cut corners there.
Well, I guess that's relatively natural with the sort of downports, like, I mean, Black Ops you spoke of,
mm-hmm,
because fundamentally it's a project about cutting things out and trying to preserve as much as possible rather than, you know, something that's built from the ground up like GoldenEye.
Yep. But also, I think the sound in it is really, really good. Like, the sound effects, like that kind of ambient sound around you. Like, there's in the first area, you kind of go underground and there's waterworks. And so there's a big, you know, rushing torrent of water going by you, and it's all this ambient sound of water, and it's really well done. I mean, more so than many other Wii games that I've played. So, I mean, if anybody that likes first-person shooters, it's certainly the best one that I've played on Wii. I mean, I haven't played Conduit 2, but I'm...
Well, that's an 8.5 right there.
True, true. Then this one would be probably about at least a 9.
Uh-oh. It's an 11?
No, I enjoyed it. I would like to... I think I've completed it on, like, the middle difficulty. Mm-hmm. I would kind of like to go higher on it one day, but, you know, there's plenty of other things to play. And also, the more the objectives kind of scale up, the more kind of it can be a little bit annoying at times, kind of going in the same way that I would get frustrated with GoldenEye and Perfect Dark on N64. But I guess we can get into that probably in the next part of Retroactive rather than this week, so we're covering the multiplayer portion.
Yeah, like, do they just throw more guys at you?
Well, no, it's when, like, it's okay, you've got to photograph these three things or neutralize these three things, and you're kind of backtracking,
yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah, it's not great.
There's things about that sort of scaling of objectives that I really liked back on, you know, the N64 rare FPS games, mm-hmm, and then at times, you know, when it wasn't sort of transparent. That's when I didn't like it. So I don't sort of relish the thought of playing it on a higher difficulty. And also, I'm not very good at the game. I'm not very good at first person shooters in general. So I enjoyed it though, certainly, although I still haven't got nearly enough out of online or anything like that, but that's just the way it goes with me. Well, I'll wrap up this brief new business segment now. First of all, I have been playing my acquisition from last week, Bangaia for N64, which is pretty much what I expected of it. The levels so far, and I've only played about 25%-ish of them, so it's a bit early. I'm not going to talk about it at length, but they are kind of just bigger versions of sort of some of the concepts that you see in the little bite-sized ones that populate the DS game in a lot of ways. So not too much to say about it just yet, but it is a lot of fun. And actually, the famous slowdown seems kind of tame compared to the DS version, actually, at least so far. Maybe in later levels it's going to get completely crazy. But my main game for this week is actually not retro, shockingly, and it is in fact a 3DS game, perhaps even more shockingly. So I picked up Dead or Alive Dimensions for 3DS when it came out last week in Europe, and it came out less than a week ago in North America. So basically I've been looking to kind of get a new portable fighting game after I had one of the Treasure developed Bleach games on DS, which I really enjoyed. I got a lot of use out of that. But in terms of this versus Street Fighter, I've got Street Fighter on the PS3. I've got plenty of use out of that. I just didn't really feel like I wanted to buy that again. But the thing with DOA is that I've never played one before. There's never been one on a Nintendo platform before, so I would never really had much of the opportunity to do so. And until relatively recently, I wouldn't have really considered it because the series does seem kind of like a joke in a lot of ways. Like back when they announced it, whatever, it didn't make any kind of impression on me. But it was going to come out in Japan just before the earthquake tragedy struck.
Right.
And I think it was reviewed in Famitsu and then didn't come out the next week because of that tragedy. And it got a very good review in Famitsu, some other good impressions coming out of Japan. And it's like, oh, well, maybe this is worth looking into. And what I sort of discovered was, like, if you go back to the last proper Dead or Alive game on 360, which is quite a long time ago now because it was an early game, that was reviewed really well. And I had, like, no idea of this. I guess just all the stupid spin-offs had sort of polluted my perception of the quality of the series.
Well, I mean, the series is... I mean, it rips off good content. I mean, Dead or Alive is sort of reviewed as sort of a ripoff of the Namco fighting games, which themselves are sort of reviewed as as ripoffs of the Sega fighting games.
The Virtua Fighter style.
Right, so it's Virtua Fighter begot Tekken begot Dead or Alive. Mm. But, I mean, the content material they're ripping from is pretty good, and the team knows what they're doing, so... the games are usually pretty solid. They're just marketed as TNA fests.
When I played it on the 3DS, I was really impressed by it. I mean, it looked really good.
Oh, was it at PAX East?
Yeah, it was at PAX. And I was like, wow, this looks amazing. I mean, and it played really well, too.
That was the only multiplayer game where I was willing to come over the stand and take out the person I was playing with.
Mm-hmm.
and we was cooperative, but then again, that's probably
not surprising. Yeah, no, that's the thing. There's a few things raised there that I would like to get onto. But yeah, I mean, the fact that, maybe a different style, like you said, like Virtua Fighter style, I haven't played any of really that kind of fighting game, apart from like a friend of mine had a Saturn and I played some Virtua Fighter.
Oh, poor bastard.
On that back in the mid-90s, this is a long time ago. So a different style, something a bit fresher for 3DS. But I mean, the first thing is, graphically, it is impressive. It really is. Mm-hmm. In terms of the stereoscopic element, I talked about playing Mortal Kombat on PS3 in 3D. And the thing about that, obviously, it's sort of, it is fixed on that 2D plane. And you've got the fact that, the camera is pretty much static and everything. So, as I said, you just kind of forget it's there. It's kind of incidental a lot of the time. But you really couldn't with the way Dead or Alive is. When people are doing throws, the camera is moving around them. And, you've got these quite large environments which you can, knock people off ledges and they go tumbling down and all this. Like, the camera's moving, it's dynamic. And so there's just things happening. The 3D is very much in your face. Mm-hmm. Yes, and it looks really good. It's definitely striking in that way. And I have actually played it most of the time with the 3D on, which, of course, is sort of a weird trade-off, because I think like Street Fighter, you've got the situation where if you have it on in 3D, it's like 30 frames a second. And if you bump it down to 2D, that kicks up to 60 frames a second. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the way this works is that all you have to do is put the slider down and it does it. I think I've heard that, I don't know whether you could confirm this, James, that there's like a menu option associated with that in Street Fighter.
Yeah, something like that.
Whereas with this, I mean, you can just go from one to the other with the flick of the switch. I mean, it's that simple. But obviously, it is super smooth and still looks great in 2D. But I don't know, I'm not at a point yet where I'm really concerned about, like, response time and stuff, because, you know, I'm just a beginner. I've not played this kind of game before. So I'm not obsessed with that sort of technical stuff. I just enjoy the look of the visuals in 3D. And I've long since got over any kind of weirdness with my vision. Like, I played Pilot Wings almost exclusively in 3D. I just don't notice that anymore.
Right. The effect is sort of diminishes the more you play the 3DS.
So from that point of view, the stereoscopic element is good. Otherwise, it's a little bit erratic in its graphic quality. Like, there's some character models that have some weirdly rough pixelated textures just here. I don't know whether it's because they're sourced from different games, because it's like a kind of best of compilation of the series, that some of these guys, you know, are kind of based on models that were for games like, you know, way before DOA 4 was on the 360 or whatever. So it's a little odd, but that's quite rare. In general, it looks really good. A lot of the environments look really cool as well, as I said. And then in terms of the fit on the hardware, what I like about it is it's a four-button game, essentially, whereas like Street Fighter,
right,
you've got six attacks and you've got the whole super meter kind of stuff as well, right? So that seems like it's a little bit stretching the 3DS's sort of button inputs, whereas here what you've got is punch and kick, then you've got a throw, and you've got hold, which you use to block and to counter. And that's it. You know, you don't even have to worry about using those awkwardly small shoulder buttons at all. Mm-hmm. So it's a great fit for the 3DS in that way. And the circle pad is actually pretty good too, because you're not doing like a lot of like special move combinations or whatever. It's not like all generally not all like crazy fireballs and stuff. You know, it's more just like combinations of punches and kicks. So the circle pad is pretty much fit for purpose. The only thing I would say is that there's times where, like, especially with certain characters, like, you could do dash moves. So you're doing a double tap forward, mm-hmm. for instance, which is always going to be quicker on the D-pad mm-hmm. than it is on something like a circle pad. So there's definite advantages to using the D-pad, but then that's small, and, you know, we've been through that. So there's little trade-offs between those two. But it does fit the portable hardware type really quite uniquely well for a fighting game, I think. And then it does also use the touchscreen for move input, but and it's a bit weird because, like, I guess, so with Street Fighter, you can choose, like, certain moves, like, to be put there, right, James? You can have, like, maybe some of the more complicated stuff.
I think so, yeah.
With this, basically what you have on the lower screen is a comprehensive move set, including, like, you know, five-button combos or whatever that you can just sort of tap at any moment with the stylus, and then it will execute them. And it's sort of a context sensitive list in that, you know, it will kind of shift according, because the list obviously of your entire moves is bigger than it can display at once with touchable icons on the lower screen. So it kind of has to shift as according to what's appropriate for the situation, which I guess it does a decent job of. But ultimately, like, I can't see anyone using that strictly for any sustained period of time, because you're focusing too much on the lower screen. You're not really looking at what's going on at the top.
Now, does it help you at all? Like, in other words, does it show you, like, hey, you know, when you're doing this or you're getting attacked in this way, you should use this move to counter it or something like that?
I think that's the most helpful it is in that sense, that it's suggesting things you could do.
Yeah.
And that you can then kind of, you know, once you see that on the lower screen enough times, you learn it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll actually just execute it with the buttons and the control pad rather than, you know, just tapping it out with the stylus. So, you know, I still think it's useful, but it's just because of the nature of the game, that it's not like you can put like one or two like super moves on there, which is what the Bleach game that I was talking about earlier for the DS, that does the same thing.
Right.
It has just a couple of super moves and more complicated moves on the bottom the way DOA is, that would never work. So it's nice that they've put it in there. It's not a huge deal. And then with the one player stuff, it's kind of funny because, you know, having this not long after Mortal Kombat, the contrast between the story modes is really funny because it does seek to achieve a similar thing, very similar, in fact, because it's like a sort of compendium of previous Dead or Alive stories, such as they are. And the cutscenes and all that kind of stuff, it's, you know, I was saying about how slick the execution was with Mortal Kombat. Well, not so much here. First of all, it's a really weird sort of melange of styles. Like, they have some CG movies from previous DOA games that have had 3D post-processing applied to them. Mm-hmm. Then you have some in-engine cutscenes that are fully animated, and they actually look very nice, and they really do show off the 3D effect. You know, you'll have, like, you know, knives being thrown directly at a character, and then they do, like, Matrix-style dodging and all that. You know, that works quite well. But then a lot of these considerable cutscenes is actually more like in a comic book style, mm-hmm. where it's not fully animated, so it's just, like, the character models in a pose still. And then the voice is just playing over that. So, you know, you're kind of going between these three styles and it's just weird. And the plot is utterly incomprehensible. I have no idea what's going on. And moreover, like, they try and explain things on the bottom screen. So you've got, like, these little footnotes. So they'll say something in the story, and then this little note will appear on the screen at the bottom, which completely fails to fill you in on what the hell is going on with this story. But it does tell you things like what the word conglomerate means.
What does the word conglomerate mean?
That's, you know, it awful. Just, I couldn't believe that. It was just so, like, I was expecting the game, frankly, to insult my intelligence, but not quite in this particular way.
How does it, in what context does it explain the word conglomerate without it feeling out of place?
Because there's, like, an evil corporation in it, and they're a conglomerate, so therefore...
So all conglomerates are evil corporations. Take that, Comcast. Well, actually, Comcast might actually be an evil corporation.
I don't think that was the exact content of the footnote, but there you go.
Take that, Beyond Petroleum.
Oh, how could you say anything bad about them? So the story mode in that presentational sense is a bit of a glorious mess, to be honest. But in terms of teaching you the game's mechanics, I think it's probably better than Mortal Kombat. It is more of a sort of explicit tutorial. It takes you through everything from the ground up, even to quite advanced techniques like sort of building in delays into executing a combo so that your opponent thinks that you've finished and lets their guard down, and then you get them again. Yeah, so it's really nice that way. So, I mean, in the end, you know, what do you care more about? This sort of, what in any case is going to be a pretty weak-ass story, or being taught how to play the game? So, I mean, it's probably a pretty good argument to be made for this on that basis. The only thing I would say about that, though, is that where it doesn't teach you quite so well is the fact that all the fights in it are very easy, curiously, for a Team Ninja game who are very famous for their difficulty. You just burn through these fights effortlessly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on the one hand, it's showing you the mechanics, but it's not really demanding that you master them by any means to go through that particular mode. And even stuff like the arcade mode, which has a bunch of different courses that ramp up in difficulty, that they're very brisk affairs, they're all pretty easy, you know. So I went through a lot of this one-player stuff, and sort of, you know, well, you know, I've learned about it, I'm getting better. And then I went online, and the results were not pleasant, because clearly there were people, maybe they played previous Dead or Alive games, you know, or maybe they just played this one for longer, and I could, yeah, barely win a match. It was embarrassing. So, I mean, I'm not blaming the game entirely for that. I'm sure most of it is my ineptitude, but the fact that it is curiously easy, a lot of this stuff.
The game did not do an adequate job preparing you for the amount of ass-beating you were about to receive.
Exactly. Certainly didn't, no. It certainly didn't. So online, it's got it, but this is really kind of your mileage may vary kind of territory, because playing the random matches, first of all, that's not great in itself, because if you play someone it takes a while to find a random player to matchmake. And then when you play them, you have no option to just rematch. It just kicks you out, and then you've got to go through the process of finding a player again.
Oh my god, that's brutal.
It's Mario Kart.
It's kind of like the total baseline kind of Nintendo platform online experience random match that you may have come to expect over the years. So that's a little disappointing that they
haven't...
giving
you exactly what you expect and not an inch better.
That's disappointing in itself. And also, I mean, I've played you know, quite a few of these random matches, and the variance in how smooth that experience has been is quite a lot, you know, quite severe, because... yeah, maybe it's geographical in terms of you can play by region or by world. I've mostly played by region, but of course, you know, if we're talking Europe, if I play someone in the UK is one thing, if I play someone in Germany, it's quite another. So it may be that just, you know, these bad connections are because they're further away. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm going to find this out because I offered to help Zach, who's reviewing the game, test the online, and he's in Alaska. So we will see if it's, you know, heavily geographically influenced on that basis. But Zach, of course, has been poorly recently. Actually, he's in hospital recovering from surgery. So, of course, we wish Zach well in this recovery. There's actually a forum thread and a talkback where you can give Zach your get well wishes. But he's looking forward to DOA, I can assure you of that.
Oh, I bet he is. I could tell you one place you didn't play people from, Greg.
The Nordic countries?
Sweden in particular.
At least Sweden, how ironic is that?
Let me reiterate, it was withdrawn, not banned.
There we go.
Let's get that straight.
Withdrawn.
But, you know, no, I mean, so I don't know how geographically based it is, but basically it's like sometimes it plays pretty much as smoothly as it does, you know, if you're playing a one-player match or local multiplayer, and then other times it slows down a lot. So that could be a problem if you're mostly going to be playing the random matches, or you only have friends who perhaps are geographically diverse, shall we say. But, I mean, I've been playing friends' stuff, you know, so someone who I know has got a 3DS, we've exchanged friend codes and all that, and that plays really well. You know, so I mean, that's been no trouble at all. And moreover, there's a lot more options when you're playing with friends. You can tinker with, you know, how big you want the life bar to be, for instance, which is actually quite important because the standard length is sufficiently short that these fights could just go by in the blink of an eye if someone puts together a particularly devastating combo or something. Like, so I quite prefer to have a longer fight with this chance for a bit of back and forth, you know. So that's one thing you can do in friends you can't do randomly. But the big thing is that you've got the tag challenge, which is basically a co-op mode. I mean, that's, I've seen a lot of reviews where people complain about this mode. They say, oh god, the AI is terrible and all that. And well, I'm sure it could be better. It probably should be better, but principally, this is a co-op multiplayer mode, and it isn't necessarily labeled as such, and you'll only know that you can do that online if you go online with a friend, and you'll see the option to do it, because I had no idea before I actually started playing it that we could do this. And that is a riot. I mean, the tag stuff, because what happens is you're kind of fighting an opponent who's almost like superpowered, like he can do like more damage than normal, but you have the ability to tag in and out and therefore regenerate health, and you have a finite number of lives you can lose before you actually take this opponent down. And that is, you know, just the sort of the panic at times of just like tag out, you know.
So the evil thing though is that you can control when your friend tags out, because ultimately it's the responsibility of the outside player to make the decision to go in.
Yes.
Which means you can basically sit there and make your poor friend scream at you to tag him out. Nope.
I mean, it's the kind of thing that really you shouldn't necessarily have to coordinate. Like, they're beating the shit out of me. I'm nearly dead. Get out now while I'm still, you know, alive and I can reach
it. But it's not your call, unfortunately.
But still, it is better to have, it doesn't have voice chat in game or anything. But like, when I've played, I have gone on Skype. It is a lot more fun that way.
It's remarkable amounts of fun in person because you can watch the look on their face as they're being pounded by a superpowered whoever from the game.
It's weird. Like, you know, some of the reviews, it's like highlighted as one of the sort of failings of the game, but played under the right circumstances, I think it's one of the best things about the game.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently, the latter parts are actually really quite hard, which would probably be the hardest things that are in the game because most of it is so easy. So, I mean, that online co-op, that's really cool. Like, it's a great feature. Mm-hmm. If you've got someone that you can play it with, or, you know, if you've registered your friend codes on our forums, you know, you can put together plenty of friends. I don't know, many of them have got DOA yet in particular.
All the perverts got it, so there you go.
Thanks for that, James.
So that's our entire forum base, actually.
But that's really fun. I mean, it's generally quite feature complete, apart from maybe the somewhat bare bonesness of the basic online. You've got a lot of Spot Pass, Street Pass stuff as well. They've been doing downloadable costumes all week since it came out, one a day, and they're going to be doing it for another couple of weeks, which is a bit cheap from the point of view, like, you can't just go and download them. It's just you have to have had your 3DS waiting to receive it that particular day.
Right.
I guess it's really a way of trying to get you to check in on the game every day. Yeah. That's the point of it. So, you know, you've got that. You've also got these throwdown challenges where it's basically like a developer ghost thing in a racing game, but applied to a fighting game. Mm-hmm. So it's like a sort of AI construct of one of the Team Ninja guys that you get to fight. And you get a figure, like a sort of reward, a mm-hmm. trophy, whether you win or lose, actually. But maybe you get something better if you win. I did not win the first
time.
Mm-hmm. But the cool thing is they basically do that for Street Pass as well. So what it does is that if you Street Pass someone who also has DOA, what you'll then get is a challenge of like an AI construct of their player behavior. So it tracks all your stats and it sort of forms this sort of virtual version of the way you fight. And then
that's pretty cool.
The machines have replaced us.
Anyone you Street Pass with, you get to play that version of them, and then it sort of, you know, it keeps a record of the fact that you won that sort of throwdown challenge. So that's very cool as well.
I beat mm-hmm. a virtual you. Suck it, virtual you.
So, I mean, I've been enjoying it quite a lot. It's a lot of fun if you've got friends to play it with, really. I mean, the one player content is not bad. You've got like a survival mode in there as well. You know, I mean, it's not as robust as something like Mortal Kombat, you know, and like I said, it's just kind of weirdly easy in general, but it's decent. And then the online for random is there. But it's all about friends. If you can have, you know, if you've got someone else who knows the game, who has the game, that you know online or you know in person, I think you could get a lot of fun out of this because it's really accessible. Like, that's the main thing I took from it. You know, the way it does teach you the basics and just the nature of the game, it fits the portable. Mm-hmm. And John, you tweeted something about this with Mortal Kombat going to a 4-button system.
Yeah.
You know, it's not shallow.
I didn't tweet anything about that John. Sorry.
The yeah. real John. The
John Lindemann. NWR Lindy.
There we go. Not the real John Lindemann.
The true John, not the real.
world, son.
It does help a lot just going to the 4-button format, because I mean, a lot of the hardest aspects of learning something like, say, like Street Fighter 4 for me is that it quickly gets into combos where you're like,
I can't stop this.
Well, it's like, you know, yeah, that, and also the fact that, you know, if you want to do something really cool, you'll have to do like move the joystick counterclockwise and then counterclockwise again, and while you're doing that, hit 3 or 4 different other buttons. And it's like,
it's just something mechanically, it just feels better if my hands don't have to think about the shoulder buttons. Especially yeah. with 3DS, I think if I was worrying about the shoulder buttons, you'd be more at risk of like the system shaking about in your hands, and mm-hmm. then, you know, you'd probably lose the 3D effect a bit and stuff. So that's what's really cool about this. It's just like 4 buttons is all you have to think about. And it's not really shallow or anything. I mean, I'm perhaps stuff like Virtua Fighter and Tekken that James sort of talked about as its progenitors are deeper. I don't know. I've not played them. But here you've just got an elegant little system where it's like you've got your basic punches and kicks. They sort of have dominance over throws, but those throws have dominance over your sort of holds and your counter moves, which have dominance over the punches and kicks. So it's a, you know, rock, paper, scissors, triangle kind of thing. And in practice, it just works really quite nicely because it does dissuade you from doing like really kind of brutally cheap spamming tactics. Because if you're predictable or if you don't mix your moves up a bit, it's really easy to counter that. You know, it's a nice little system that just, I don't know how deep I'm going to go with it, whether I'm ever going to get to the point where it's like, oh, you know, I've got to turn the 3D off and go to 60 frames and get really good at it or anything like that. But it's plenty fun before you ever get to that point.
Yep.
So it's worth considering if you think you can actually get the mileage out of it with friends and stuff. All right, well, we're now going to wrap up new business, and then after now playing during the break, we're going to move on to some of your listener mail. So join us for that.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with an interview about a Cartoon Network Punch Time explosion. We talked with the senior producer of the game at Papaya Studio to give us extensive insight on how this Smash Brothers inspired brawler for 3DS came to be and everything that makes it unique. Aaron also has impressions of Fast Racing League, which apparently has shades of F-Zero GX and Ikaruga combining to form an impressive WiiWare title.
Danny, our newest Japanese correspondent, has a nice collection of impressions for you. We have the Tentai Show and Pull Pull Pulpy, both of which we've discussed here on RFN.
With disgust.
No.
they're both pretty good.
Yeah.
The two entries in the DS Games Seminar 2010 titles, and hot off the presses, we have impressions of the Carnivore's Delight Pandora's Tower, in which you feed dead monsters to a vegetarian.
Yeah, to prevent it from turning into like an octopus monster or something. Detailed descriptions inside the impressions.
Who says Nintendo only makes games for children?
All right, on the review front, we have a review of Thor, God of Thunder, by Josh Max.
Which sounds like the name of a character in Thor, God of Thunder.
Exactly. It's.
I don't believe your name is real, Josh Max.
Yeah, I don't believe it either.
Josh Min is his real name.
And apparently Thor hits just as hard in this game as he does in the movie, but with less feeling. And in Extra Life, we have TMNT, that's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, for those of you not raised in the 80s. TMNT, Tournament Fighters, Pedro, he says, the Turtles throw their hat into the ring, and they come out victorious in this classic SNES fighter.
Do Turtles wear hats?
They wear bandanas, apparently.
Think about that in your brain.
We also have a bunch of news about Shinobi coming back for 3DS, Sonic Generations for 3DS, and our ongoing Zelda characters feature, in which Pedro most recently discussed Link's uncle in Link to the Past, that heroic man who seemed to die but comes back in the ending. So you could check out all that stuff and more at NintendoWorldReport.com. Back to part two of the show. We are still Mets-less at the minute, unfortunately.
I.e. cruising along just fine.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to soldier on without him for the time being. We expect him fairly soon. So, listener mail. We're going to get into more of your letters. Obviously, we couldn't last week with the E3 preview segment taking up the lion's share of the last episode. But here we bring the two together because
it's synergy.
A very interesting and thoughtful letter from someone responding to our E3 preview, an anonymous listener, but nonetheless had some very interesting thoughts that I thought we could just go over quickly as a little follow-up to last week's discussion. So, first of all, one thing he wanted to raise was about the whole eShop, how seriously Nintendo's going to take the sort of digital element to the platform. I did want to point out that, you know, there's some hope perhaps for the 3DS of being more serious in this regard, because hardware design itself was actually overseen by someone who has a software background, which is Hideki Kono of EAD Group 1 in Kyoto. So, I mean, that carries a certain amount of weight with me, perhaps. That
sure, but Miyamoto played a big role in previous hardware.
It's not foreign for Nintendo to have software developers playing a big role in hardware design. I mean, you could argue it's one of the things that has made Nintendo platforms in the past unique, where people think, you know, that you can see that a controller is, it seems to be built expressly for something like Mario 64, or, you know.
Yeah,
that.
And I mean,
it's a good strategy.
Well, they may also just kind of look at it, like, they may also just offer their input, you know, in terms of the concept of the hardware, not the, necessarily the nuts and bolts of, say, how it handles, you know, online play or friend codes or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a great deal that we can necessarily infer from it, but it's an interesting point. Although, I mean, Miyamoto continues to make positive noises about, well, you know, if we're going to do digital games for 3DS, you know, they're going to be worthwhile experiences, you know, we're going to kind of take it seriously. But unless they get up there at E3 and say, you know, one of the announcements is, you know, that we've got this prominent franchise being given like a digital installment of some sort. I mean, it's not completely unprecedented. They've done, like, was it Mario versus DK Minis March Again, I think, is the DSi.
Right, and then they went back and made a full DS game out of it because they don't know what the hell they want.
That's right. They went back to retail afterwards. But
I don't know what's going on in this company anymore.
It would be nice to see. That would be something I'd look for. It's one original game, digital, that just, you know, that obviously we've got, you know like the Mega Man Legends demo or whatever that's been delayed, and they won't be able to talk about that as being out now anymore.
All I want is Planked the game for download.
I think that would shore things up, because it's something they haven't really done. You know, probably March of the Minis is about as far as they've gone in terms of, like, here is a flagship Nintendo property. You know, Nintendo have published a lot of cool stuff on their downloadable platforms, Art Style games and Xscape and stuff like that. You know, they're cool games.
The Art Academy stuff, I mean, those were so big, they got released as actual games.
Yeah,
like,
they've split bits up of games that already exist. They've reconstituted downloadable bits into retail games. They've done this, but it would be nice to see Nintendo put that kind of weight and say, here's something, you know, that feels really serious. What the match would be in that regard, I'm not really too sure.
Download 10 new Pokemon each week for $10. Do you want Mew 3? Well, you better pay for it, son.
That is the massively online, if not multiplayer, experience.
That's right.
That
massively online single player.
But another point that was raised was about Mario Kart, in terms of, you know, it seems like a great fit as the 3DS killer app, not just because of how big Mario Kart is, which is what we talked about last week, but the fact that it is actually, the development is being overseen by Hideki Kono, who is kind of the father of the 3DS, and so is very likely to take advantage of all the features, you know, that we talked about, so Street Pass, Bot Pass, all that kind of stuff, which, yeah, I would expect. I mean, it's like ghost data.
It's very easy, like, if they didn't. Really.
Yeah, why wouldn't they? I mean, that's the thing. I guess, like, with something like Super Mario.
That's right, it doesn't take advantage of any of the features.
Yeah, and I mean, you'd have to force it a bit, right?
It's, yeah, but still, I mean, it's checkbox. You gotta check off the checkboxes.
Maybe, but I mean, it's still, it's like, I guess the biggest thing that I could think of would be like some sort of replay. I mean, certainly I could see it in Galaxy, like, you know, in Galaxy 2, there's some of those time attack missions you have to do. Like, you could save something like that and then maybe, you know, distribute that to your friends or something, or through Street Pass. But the thing is, if this is more of an exploration kind of Mario, maybe it doesn't lend itself to that sort of thing anymore. So Mario Kart, I've no doubt, is going to be...
Well, I mean, remember, they used Mario Kart DS to sell the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection.
Yeah, I mean, Mario Kart has... And of course, on Wii. Mario Kart Wii, you know, has really nice online, you know, it's got some cool friends integration in terms of, like, you could see how well your friends have done, like, on Time Attack on a given course and all that kind of thing. You know, I mean, the logical kind of extensions to that you could see with 3DS, the social kind of stuff.
Yeah, extend the online tournaments, I'm sure.
Tweet that you just blue-shelled the hell out of the leader. Auto-tweets everywhere.
In all seriousness, I think the one thing I would like to see out of Mario Kart 3DS, above all else... First of all, better battle mode.
Yeah.
You know, something that really just gets back to the roots a little bit, you know, like the whole team-based thing on Mario Kart Wii is not really, you know, I think most what most people like about battle mode, and particularly probably if they played it on N64 and stuff. But, I mean, also just like a general kind of approach, you know, a bit like with GoldenEye, like Johnny's talked about this, how like the single player is one game, the local multiplayer is another game, and online is a different game again. separate the experiences a little bit. You know, maybe, you know, for instance, in the one player game, you don't have to have quite the same level of churn in terms of like people switching places and crazy items because it is a one player game. So we're not worrying about everyone staying competitive,
right.
And, you know, sort of delineating them in that way. I think that would be a healthy evolution of the series.
And number three, a dating sim mode.
Well, funny you said, but Pandora's Tower apparently has dating sim elements in it.
that's really unnerving given the content of that
game.
Does
that mean that we will definitely never get it?
I think the fact that you're feeding a vegetarian demon carcasses pretty much settles that we were never getting that game.
But the important thing is how you deliver it. If it's like, here's your demon carcass, love, then your love meter must go low. Whereas if
right.
you sort of serve it up in sort of nouveau cuisine style.
You've got the candlelight flickering. You've got the bouzouki player over there making the whole scene that much more.
You could just wolf it down, pretend it's venison, and be done with it. But the last thing Alyssa wanted to comment on was predictably Project Cafe and what kind of games we might see at the show, which is obviously, I mean, you know, we're in the realms of pure speculation here. But one of the things he mentioned was the fact that Iwata recently has been making quite a lot of noise about Nintendo wanting to cooperate more with Western developers in the vein of what they've done with Monster Games, who've made, you know, Excitebots, Excite Truck before that, Pilot Wings Resort, of course. So, I mean, they are like go-to guys for launch games, apparently.
For games that we don't publicize existing.
Mm-hmm. And also Next Level Games, who made Punch Out for Wii, and before that, the Mario Strikers games. So, you know, talking about maybe having similar partnerships to those, you know, but with different developers, but also, you know, we must assume that they are probably going to, you know, that if they value these kinds of partnerships so much, then they're probably going to keep, you know, mining the ones they have. So those developers could be interesting to watch out for on the new system. I said in the prediction show, Next Level really need to do something with Nintendo.
That's
again.
Next Level.
After their abysmal on-rail shooter forays.
Or about like, something that's just current level, because that what their last offering was below level. He also mentions Team Ninja, which is in the Western development.
Yeah, I mean, Team Ninja, so obviously you mentioned Dimensions in their business there at length, and there does seem to be a relationship there with Nintendo and Tecmo Koei these days, more broadly, because don't forget the Fatal Frame stuff in Japan.
Yeah,
as well, obviously we don't get. And the Samurai Warriors, the Koei part as well, the Nintendo kind of teamed up with them on the Samurai Warriors 3.
They did, so they let...
The Nazo no Murasamacho mode in there, and they helped distribute it in Europe and stuff.
Right.
Like, they are pretty damn tight with Tecmo Koei.
And they left poor Sengoku Basara, which is infinitely more awesome, to fend for itself. Which, by the way, you should definitely play Sengoku Basara Samurai Heroes, because your life will never be the same.
It is going really cheap. It is tempting.
If you like 80s movies.
What kinds of 80s movies? There are plenty of 80s movies. Like, are we talking like Splash?
The ones that involved action scenes. Action scenes and cocaine.
I think the one thing we could say about Team Ninja, obviously they waited to unveil their next Ninja Gaiden game. It's going to be their big thing at E3, I guess we all assume. But
yeah.
One thing we can say about someone like Team Ninja is this sort of Japan development partner that Nintendo has that is certainly well-versed in these kinds of graphical fields. You know, they're someone who knows how to build a great-looking game on a HD system already.
Yeah. Right.
So if they have got a nice relationship there, it would seem like a logical thing to mine for the new system. Maybe a version of the new Ninja Gaiden, maybe something different. I guess it's not long since they did Other M, so I don't know whether they could have anything for launch, but, you know, they're definitely something to look out for, I think. So it's a lot of possibilities. For the cafe stuff.
So many options.
But I guess the really tricky thing is just like, everyone's going to say, you need a real big gun. You know, like Johnny said, not Pikmin. You're not going to be the biggest thing. You know, you've got to have something that's like a Mario Zelda type. But
right.
You've got Mario on 3DS. You've got Zelda on 3DS and Wii.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you...
They've already doubled down on Zelda.
Yeah, where's the development bandwidth? And just from like a perceptions point of view, not wanting to like completely overshadow everything else, like...
Pokemon Snap, done. We're out of here.
Yeah, I don't know if they'll really necessarily have a big gun. I just don't think they'll have something for a launch necessarily.
But do you want, I guess the problem is, do you get caught in a Luigi's Mansion situation again?
I think that's not
a good place to be.
But the thing is, it seems like every console seems to get in that, though. I mean, when's the last time a console launched with a super huge launch game?
Wii?
I mean, Twilight Princess, but it's a bit of a cheat.
Yeah, that was a GameCube game.
Well, on that subject, is that completely off the table?
No, it's not. It's not ideal. I mean, it's not a good plan, but if it comes down to it...
So you're not ruling out Skyward Sword getting a dual release?
I think it would be foolish of them to do it, because I think their goal needs to be to say that this is much more powerful than the Wii, so let's not make our lead platform game a Wii port.
Well, I mean, one thing, what about Smash Bros.? Is that something?
Maybe, but I mean, they like to be very public about the development of Smash Bros. I mean, they like to talk...
Well, yeah, once they fire the starting pistol, but I mean, do you think...
They fired the starting pistol before the gun was loaded last time, remember?
They did a bit, that's true, before they even
Before they even had a development staff, they had a trailer.
That's right. Well, I mean, Sakurai's busy with Kid Icarus. Maybe it seems a bit fanciful to have that early on.
Well, I mean, he has like a 93-person studio. I doubt they're all working on a 3DS game. And Nintendo was the proprietary funder of said studio, so they could be working on something.
Yeah, a launch, probably not, but I would be a little surprised, in fact, if you didn't have some sort of Smash Brothers concept video shown, It's like, you know, because the Smash Brothers versions of Nintendo characters are always, like, a bit more detailed than they normally are. Like, you have the texture of the denim on Mario's jeans or whatever,
right.
So that kind of lends itself to, like, oh, it's your characters in HD a lot more than like, a lot of games would.
Seeing as I anticipate we're probably going to get another E3 before Cafe comes out, it might not be this E3 that we get the teaser video.
Yeah, that's what you got to bear in mind, isn't it?
Yeah, I got it, though. Odama. Odama's your AAA launch title.
Well, with that, we are going to leave the E3 preview stuff for now, at least. It will be tremendously exciting with the new system and all that. I'm looking forward to it. I really, God, I hope they say something about an F-Zero game. I'm not hungry for F-Zero.
Yeah, yep.
He hungers for the tube sliders. Wait, what?
What, huh?
Tube sliders. So we will now move on to the rest of the listener mail, and the first one James has.
Mark in England writes, because I recommended the DS game 999 on the show, Mark decided to import it into Europe, and he's loving it. All right, now I'm going to be reading this, Mark. So I was wondering, what games have been recommended to you that you've then bought and loved? A good recommendation for you is Nier, an incredibly fun game with the best soundtrack ever made. No overreaction. First off, when somebody says no overreaction, they're never overreacting, ever.
They're borderline stoic.
So I've heard very good things about the soundtrack to that game. I haven't personally heard the soundtrack itself, but with respect to the quality of the game, it's kind of mixed, but I don't really know much about it.
So I read some reviews based on this, because Johnny then responded to the email saying, I've heard about this game, James, it's for you personally. This game is psychotic. I mean, there's a sequence that apparently is all text-based.
Okay.
It's basically an action-adventure kind of game where you're out trying to kill monsters, but occasionally you also have to go grocery shopping for people in town.
Right.
That has James written all over it.
It's apparently completely insane.
Intrigued?
Maybe a little bit in the what kind of way. Games recommended to me personally, I mean, I've covered this on the show. I ended up playing both of the Touch Detective games due to a recommendation, and adored
them. That's a good example. I mean, for me, I've got an interesting one, because it's not a specific game in a way, but I guess the first game you would associate with it is Sin and Punishment for the N64. So I had a friend, the same friend I referenced earlier with the Saturn back in the 90s.
This friend...
He got big into like the import scene on the Saturn, which I guess is natural considering that's like where all the good games were.
The only games that were released.
So he had like Mega Man X games, like he had the expansion RAM thing, that whatever the hell that was for the Saturn, you know, that you could like play these fancy 2D games with, like some of the fighting games and stuff. And he got really into Treasure stuff. You know, he was a Sega guy. I think he played at least some of the Mega Drive Treasure games as well. And of course, I hadn't played any of them. And he was like, oh, you know, because I love Contra and stuff like that. Like, oh, you would really love a lot of these games, like Treasure. They're awesome. And I had no idea, you know, really, you know, I'd read a bit about them, but, you know, being in the Nintendo side, I was pretty well insulated. I didn't know very much about them. But then, like, stuff like Mischief Makers came along, and I wasn't really kind of swayed on that because it was, you know, a platformer. And, of course, Bangaia was just super hard to get a hold of until now. So,
right.
You know, but then when Sin and Punishment came along and you had the reviews, you know, they were good reviews, but it was like, it's kind of, you know, it's very short, you know, it's not really great bang for your buck. And of course, it was going to be an expensive proposition for me to get it. But in the end, it was just the fact that my friend who played these treasure games said, you would love the stuff they make. That's what pushed me over the edge. And thus began the great treasure love affair that I've had for the rest of my life. So that's a pretty good one, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not going to berate that selection.
John, have you got
John,
something?
I will, though. I don't care what John suggests.
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, some of the games, I mean, I'll hear it from you guys. I mean, because, you know, you guys tend to, you know, actually play games, whereas, you know, I dabble.
Stop it. I'm supposed to make that joke.
I dabble, but yeah, I mean, you know, an example is when Johnny, he loved Fluidity, and he said that I should get that. And that's a game where, you know, I'd heard good things about it, but I probably never would have picked it up. But, you know, Johnny was raved about it repeatedly over a couple of episodes, and so I figured I'd pick it up, and it's really, really good. And also, you know, just from this episode here, definitely I would not have picked up GoldenEye if TYP and Johnny wouldn't have said, you know, it's good enough to buy. It's definitely, you would definitely like it.
I mean, I think sometimes context kind of matters in that way, you know, like, I guess for some people, you know, if someone like TYP could say something who they know isn't like completely in the tank for that genre.
Yeah.
Right.
It can mean more. I think that's where like personal recommendations kind of come into play more, because your reviews, you know, a lot of the time they do try and take the personal element out of it.
Yeah.
It's hard.
And also, I mean, we just saw here with Nier. I mean, you know, because we know James' tastes, somebody can say, hey, you know, James, I played this game and maybe I don't like it. Even if they don't like it, they can say, I think you would really like this game, just because if somebody knows your taste, they can more easily recommend something. And I
know
that
there's nothing wrong with The Last Remnant, damn it.
I think you've elucidated about what's wrong with it, which is the texture pop in. And
well, no, it's the lack of textures is actually the problem. Yeah.
All right, well, now we're going to move on to the next letter, which will be read by Johnny.
Remy writes, I love adventure RPGs. They are by far my favorite kind of games. I'm thrilled about the current trend of bringing so many to the DS, but there's something that troubles me. They are really darn long. I guess to some people, a 40-hour core game, no side quests, is welcome. But to me, this is just way too long. If it's a 20-hour core game, then 50 hours with side quests, that's fine. But I don't like the feeling of having to play through all 40 hours to finish it, even though I'll probably do the side quests anyway. One of the reasons I love Costume Quest so much is because it was a great RPG and could be finished in a few hours. Conversely, Final Fantasy XIII took me around 55 hours, and that's doing a minimum amount of side quests. My question, in brief, is why do you think RPGs are so long to begin with? My guess would be that RPGs are most popular in Japan, and those from the Japanese culture are much more patient by nature, and Americans tend to want everything here, now, and done in as little time as possible. I hope that's not racist or culturist. I just wanted to know what you guys thought about the reasoning behind it was, and if you could recommend any RPGs that are shorter than your average one. Inspired by John, I just replayed through Chrono Trigger and was pleased by the complete experience from roughly 20 hours.
Dr. Jonathan Metz, everyone. 0 to 60, like that.
Podcast just got way more depressing.
He's a professional.
Elvis is in the building.
He is a professional.
Yeah, fat, boring Elvis. Let's
go. I will
go.
Be ceding hosting duties to Johnny from now on because I'm getting a sore throat.
How are you guys doing? I have to warn the listeners and you guys that I literally just walked in the door from a business trip. I have no idea what you guys have been talking about.
Neither does John, so what's the difference?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting here playing Halo. I mean, what are you talking about? I don't know. What's going on?
Who earns?
Well, I'm glad you got here for the RPG question anyway. I feel unqualified to shepherd
the entire premise of this letter makes me...
Yeah, I mean, Mass Effect, Elder Scrolls kind of blow this away, I think, in terms of, you know, East versus West, I think.
That's a good point, yeah. And Fallout 3 and Fallout New Vegas are really long.
But I mean, even going all the way back, I mean...
And The Witcher 2 are supposed to be super long, and those are European RPGs.
Like, that's the thing. I mean, like, in terms of RPGs, I mean, Western RPGs actually predate Japanese RPGs, do they not?
That's true. Final Fantasy is based on Dragon Quest, is inspired by Dragon Quest. Dragon Quest is inspired by Wizardry, which is an American computer game from extreme early 80s.
Yeah.
I've never played Wizardry. I'm kind of scared of it. It's one of those first-person hallway RPGs that I don't like much.
But even, I mean, even like, you know, games like Zork and stuff, which were text RPGs effectively.
Text adventure more than RPG, because there's no combat, there's no experience levels. But a lot of that stuff dates back to Dungeons & Dragons, which is, again, an American pen and paper RPG from the 70s. So yeah, I mean, I think you're right that culturally, this is probably a misconception. I don't think Remy is the only person who thinks that way. You know, I think a lot of people feel that way. But again, and also there are a lot of short Japanese RPGs, like Chrono Trigger.
Wait, any other recommendations on that
Final
basis?
Fantasy IV is not that long, especially the Super Nintendo version. So if you want, if you'd like to get the story and the experience of FF4 without playing a really long RPG, don't play the DS one because it's really hard, which makes it take longer. Play the Super Nintendo one, which is on Virtual Console.
The baby's version.
Which you can play it, you can beat it in 25 hours.
Now, why do you think these games are so long?
Because that makes them better.
Well, I think it's just because, I mean, content. I mean, I think James is right to a degree in the fact that the longer these games are, people see value in that.
That's part of it.
They perceive value.
Does it have something to do also with the fact that, you know, the kind of satisfaction that an RPG can bring in terms of building up your characters, to some extent naturally plays out over a longer form?
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's a lot easier to build up complex characters in a television show than it is in a movie. Which is not to say you can't do it in a film, but it takes more skill probably. And you probably can only build up one or two interesting characters rather than a huge ensemble. That's why you don't really have ensemble cast movies except maybe Robert Altman. So that's much more common in a television series where you can stretch it out over 5 years and you spend a lot more time with these people over time. So, you know, I think in the sense of wanting to tell this epic story with multifaceted characters, having a longer game allows you to do that in some ways. Although, to be fair, in a lot of Japanese RPGs, the actual plot development is very thin. I mean, it's spread out over, there's giant chunks of just battle.
Well, I think also, it's become a lot easier to build huge worlds. So you build the huge world, and then you're like, hey, we have to fill it up with something like a story and characters.
Well, I think there's a certain draw that is implicit in that genre of building the huge world. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, if you build a huge world, you need to give the players time to see it all. Mm. So part of what comes with the whole fantasy RPG genre is the fantasy part of the fantasy RPG, which means there needs to be a world that it exists in. And for that to happen, they have to actually build a world.
Yeah. Well, and it has to be revealed to you gradually, you think, you know, so it kind of feels more like you're discovering bits of it at a time, and it's not just like, you know, you don't get to ride Flammy from the start and go everywhere you like, you know. It's like you have to be kind of gradually introduced, like you are, you know, like the typical kind of hero's journey thing. You're going out into the unknown.
This is all Homer's fault.
You know, the great thing about RPGs, and this is pretty genre-wide, this is pretty general, is that there's a lot of personal style in how long it takes you to play these games. I mean, James blows through them relatively fast. As we've seen, I tend to be fairly slow with how I play through them. And we had similar experiences. It's just, you know, a matter of how much attention we devoted to it, how aggressive you are, because the enemies scale upward as you get deeper into the game, and so does your character. There's a lot of personal style, and, you know, you can push really deep into the game before you're ready, and it will be much more difficult, but the rewards are greater, relatively speaking, because the experience points you get from defeating the difficult enemies will level you up really fast. So if you're willing to save often and not grind at all and just play as far as you possibly can, you're much more likely to get wiped out and have to restart from a save or something, or lose half your gold in Dragon Quest. But then if you do actually manage to beat the enemies, then you will level up much, much faster, and you'll get to the same place as someone who sat back and grinded on the easy enemies for many, many hours, and you'll do it in much less time. So it really comes down to a lot to how you actually play these games, you know?
I guess, you know, over a more extensive format, that kind of individuality that you bring to the characters, the approach, and, you know, the way that you build them up has more time to play out and sort of, you know, more diverse kind of areas to branch into. You know, if you're trying to achieve that in a condensed period, just from a gameplay point of view, it's probably more difficult. Again, you know, you could argue, well, if you do it really skillfully, you could do it quicker, and that would be nice for some people who want a more condensed experience. But I think, you know, it's just, it is a kind of a bigger canvas to paint on in terms of gameplay development.
Well, now, what I find is really interesting is between, you know, East versus West is how RPGs have kind of, especially in the West, they kind of went down and now they're kind of coming back. And I think one of the reasons why they're coming back, ironically, is because companies are kind of starting to, you know, blend first-person shooters, which have been really popular in the West over the past decade, 15 years or so. They're starting to blend that. It seems like they almost plateaued and they said, we have to do something to bring some more depth to this first-person shooter experience. And so now you have games like Mass Effect 2.
Well, and John, but don't set aside the RPG elements of something like Call of Duty 4.
Exactly. Very, very true.
Or Call of Duty Black Ops. That is the multiplayer of that game is an RPG. And
yeah,
the interesting thing is that was driven by market forces. It is very much what you mentioned before of wanting people to feel like they get more value because they don't want people to trade it in. So they want to keep selling new copies and they don't want those used copies to be on the market. So they're like, what can we add to this experience that will make people addicted to it, that will make them want to play for hundreds of hours?
Yeah.
And so they made their first person shooter into an RPG. It was incredibly successful.
I mean, one of the things that these days, of course, is if you are dealing, you know, with JRPGs as they have kind of migrating to portables, is that portables lend themselves better to an extensive kind of format as well. You know, because it's kind of plausible that you could set aside that amount of time if you, you know, like John, you're commuting every day. So you want something that's going to be able to absorb a lot of that time where you wouldn't necessarily be able to do very much else. So again, it's a different reasons from back when we, you know, playing them on the Super Nintendo or something. But again, it does lend itself very much to having an extensive experience.
I disagree. Personally, I think that's personal. For me, I'd rather play my RPGs relaxing in my recliner watching them on a big TV.
I understand that, but I think the fact that what's happening in Japan in particular in that respect shows that there is a market that plays them that way.
Sure.
It's not everyone by any means.
I don't think it's implicitly better one way or the other. I think
it's not, but it's that market in Japan, it's better for them, and that's bankable.
Yeah, but again, that's also based on development costs, so there's multiple factors driving that. But I'm with James. There aren't that many opportunities to play RPGs on the TV anymore. There aren't that many coming out, and also I don't necessarily have time to do it, but that would be my preferred way to do it. I mean, I beat Final Fantasy 13, it took me 60 hours or whatever, and I played all of it sitting there on my couch playing it on my HDTV, and I would do it again with another game like that. So I enjoyed that experience, you know.
Although, I mean, I would say, you know, I'm sure there are cases in RPGs where, you know, and other kinds of games, I would certainly say this of certain Zelda games, that they are long for length's sake.
Padded.
Yeah, they're padded because, you know, of expectations. It's like, oh, well, you know, people expect it to be this big. You know, they've got some idea in their minds about how epic it's meant to be, and they feel the need to make it long, whether or not they've necessarily got the content to sustain that.
Well, it bothers me more in a Zelda game, because in Zelda you can't be aggressive and go beyond your level.
Yeah,
it's gated. So Nintendo very strictly controls how fast you can move through a Zelda game.
I agree with that.
I think a good example is the bullshit teardrop whatever collecting you had to do in Twilight Princess.
Yeah, they've done it in, I would say, leaving out Majora's Mask, every 3D Zelda is overstuffed. Wind Waker has they took a dungeon out, so they put the Triforce Hunt in. And Twilight Princess, you go through the woods like three times. There's padding in these games. And that's one thing I really hope we don't see from Skyward Sword, that they have the courage to say, let's just make this long.
How about if you're going to make it long, produce enough real content for it to be that long?
Well, they've certainly had time to do that on Skyward Sword.
Yeah,
just
for sure.
Make it as long as the content supports. Don't see what you've got and then go, this is 5 hours, too short. You know what we should do?
Right.
Is make them go on this little doodad quest and then...
Well, that's the rare form of development. I mean, this game is 27 hours too short. Let's make them go find 800,000 banana peels.
Yeah, and I think in an RPG, in a real RPG, which Zelda's, I mean, I'm sure we can all agree, is not really a straight RPG.
It isn't.
It has it overlaps in some ways. Yeah. But in a real RPG, whether it's Western or Eastern style, it's hard to argue that games are drawn out or overly compressed, because a lot of it comes down to how numbers are compared against each other. And
yeah.
And again, the player generally has a lot of control over that. But certainly there are very, I mean, if Remy is asking for more recommendations, I would say Costume Quest is a very good one. You can beat that game in 5-6 hours. It's really fun. If you like Mario RPG, you should really try it. It's on PlayStation and Xbox. Unfortunately, not Wii. It'd be a great 3DS game. Great DS game, really. But it's just, you know, Double Fine's such a small company. I don't think they're going to be able to produce a lot of ports and things like that. But I do hope they'll continue it. And I do have the Grubbins on Ice DLC pack. I would say that it certainly doesn't do anything that the main game doesn't do, but it does take you to a couple of new areas. It's not just one new area. It's not all on ice. That's the beginning of it. It probably adds 2-3 hours more content, depending on how you play it. It adds a couple new costumes, which are the real draw of that game. And I think, you know, for $5 or whatever they charge for it, it's worth it. I enjoyed it. And then also, staying on Xbox for a sec, as I've mentioned before, Cthulhu Saves the World is a very short, very accelerated RPG. I mean, you level up almost every battle, and the battles are very streamlined so that it skips over. I mean, the text scrolls by super fast. It takes out a lot of the tasks like healing after battles that kind of bog down other RPGs. It just streamlines all that stuff really well, and your character moves super fast on the screen. And then the game that the same guy did before is called Breath of Death 7. It's very similar, so that would be another choice.
Breath of Death.
As I call it, Breath of Death.
It's great.
And then also Guadia Quest and Retro Game Challenge. If you can ever find a copy of it, Guadia Quest is really, although it takes a while to unlock it, it's not like you can access it from the beginning. But Guadia Quest is really fun, and it's super accelerated version of Dragon Quest. So you can definitely go with that too.
Obviously, the only option here is Infinite Space. As its name would imply, it's quite short and easy
Elder
to get
Scrolls,
through.
Oblivion, why not? Toss 300 hours at that guy.
Do not believe these people.
Yeah.
Okay, well, John has the next letter.
All right, Chris from Chicago writes, "The recent launch of the 3DS and the upcoming reveal of Project Cafe have caused me to reflect on the catalogs of the Wii and DS. The Wii's catalog has a handful of timeless classics, accompanied by mostly mediocre software. The DS's library, on the other hand, has dozens of quality titles, but not as many that I would consider masterpieces. When considering what makes you satisfied with the console's library, is it more important to have a few titles that are classics, or dozens of titles that are good, but fewer that are truly excellent? In other words, what is more important to you, a higher average quality or a few outliers that far outshine the rest? Assume that these are mutually exclusive, even though they don't necessarily have to be."
So are we being asked which do we prefer, Wii or DS?
see, you know, I mean, for me, the quintessential example of, you know, having an impressive lineup of like real classics, but, you know, not the breadth beneath that is the N64. That's the one to talk about more so than the Wii, I would say.
Yeah, like Ocarina of Time and everything else.
Yeah, Ocarina, Mario.
Majora's Mask, yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about stone cold classics, but if you had a wider palette and a lot of money to spend, you know, it was a bit like, for me, the N64 was kind of the right console at the right time in a way, because I was importing that. I was never going to be buying a lot of games, so I bought a few games, and a lot of them were like really damn good. But if you go now, if the Wii's lineup was like the N64's, like, I would be really thinking like, God, you know, I'd like to be buying more games, but I'm not. So I think how you consume games at a given moment is somewhat what influences whether you would prefer one over the other.
For me personally, I want depth to my lineup, because N64 was painful. Yeah, every game that came out seemingly was a classic, but it was partially made classic by the fact there was a 2-month window before the next game came out. I mean, if your only development studios were rare in during the time frame where they like to delay games for apparently no reason other than to delay them.
Well, they did delay them, but it's worth remembering that they were prolific as well. Like, maybe those games were all coming out or like 6 months later than they should have been, but in general, like...
or in Perfect Dark case, way later than
they were putting out, like, a bunch of games all the time. You know, and some of them were really quite different from each other, like Blast Corps versus Banjo-Kazooie.
They got worse as that generation went on, though.
No, because they Perfect Dark was in 2000, Conker was in 2001.
I mean with the delays.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, Conker got kicked down the road how many times?
Well, it was completely redeveloped.
Yeah.
At least 3 times.
It essentially cannot be quantified how it was delayed, because it's not the same. Duke Nukem Forever technically is closer to being released because it's just a different
game. I know what you mean. Maybe you savor them more when you haven't had one for a while. You know, maybe that inflated how good some of the games seemed in a way.
The only development teams working on them were some of the best, so the average is much higher. And while that's great, I mean, if you wanted to go down the review archive on a Game Informer issue, you think, wow, N64 is like the console for good developers. Man, PlayStation's a rough place. But then you go and you realize, oh, but it's got 18 more columns.
Yeah.
Never mind.
I suppose the other thing would be, like, you know, kind of going back to the Wii and DS thing, if you have the really broad lineup and a numerous lineup of something like DS, then Wii could afford to be more sort of based around a few key titles, because you have got like a constant stream of gaming going on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and also it's got Virtual Console, which,
yeah,
if you're including Virtual Console in the Wii library, then it's probably the best of all time. But
yeah,
that's not really fair, you know, that's not really apples to apples. I think, you know, in 10 years, I will look back more fondly on the games I played on DS. They were more esoteric. It was because it was a larger library, it was easier to find things that were like really Johnny games, you know? Mm. Whereas on the Wii, I own 20 Wii games now, and I've probably traded in as many over the years because I did so many reviews and things. And there are some excellent games. I mean, I don't own any bad Wii games because I traded all the crappy ones in. So, I mean, I have a really excellent library of Wii games, and I have quite a few of them. But the ones that I like, I think my favorite Wii games, I probably like less than my favorite DS games.
I also feel with the Wii, you have several games that, you know, it's kind of hard to get a handle because, you know, they never came over from Japan. You had, you know, some, it's just hard. It's hard to feel like you've really seen the entire breadth of the entire Wii game roster, really. Whereas with the DS, there's so many games that came out. You knew that you were getting pretty much everything that came out in Japan, aside from the absolute most either weird titles or obscure titles.
Yeah, Face Training.
Yeah, or titles that they just couldn't translate.
And a lot of those ended up coming to Europe anyway.
Yeah.
So you could always import those.
So I feel like with Wii, almost all the games that I own now and that I really like are all Nintendo games, whereas on the DS, as we've mentioned before, the third-party support was just much higher quality on the DS.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my favorite, and Nintendo didn't make as many games on the DS as they have for Wii, I don't think.
Certainly not in relative terms. You know, I mean, the share on Wii is vastly greater, isn't it, of Nintendo content.
Yeah. So, there aren't many third party games on the Wii that I really like, and there are a lot of them on the DS. That gives you more variety, you know?
Yeah.
It just makes the library feel like it has a lot more
depth to it. Variety, diversity is a little bit different than, you know, I mean, here the dichotomy that's presented is between quality and, you know, frequency. Whereas variety is something else again, because you might have a relatively small collection of games,
mm-hmm.
but they could be incredibly diverse and therefore serve you in a lot of different ways, and you're satisfied with that. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if you've got 30 great games, for instance, but, you know, a lot of them are kind of duplicative.
So that's the TurboGrafx-16 model.
Yeah. Hmm. All concentrated in side-scrolling shooters or whatever. That's the thing you can't argue with about the DS, is just the variety of it. But, you know, Wii also has some impressive variety on it when you think of... And a lot of that is, you've got to hand it to Nintendo these days. They really do publish a great variety of things, you know. You run the gamut from Wii Party to Sin and Punishment 2, that is pretty broad. Mm-hmm.
Not many publishers can compete with that. And it helps that they do publish a lot of third-party games, which, you know, Sin and Punishment's a third-party game. It's third-party developed. A lot of the Touch Generation stuff was third-party developed. And now they're publishing stuff like Dragon Quest VI, which is something that Nintendo probably doesn't even have the capacity to make games like that in-house. They've been pretty good about knowing what they're not so good at, and there aren't many genres that Nintendo really doesn't bother with. I mean, first-person shooters is probably the only one left.
But I guess, I mean, that's the thing. Probably to me, variety is more important than the frequency. And so, you know, obviously quality is important. You know, it's always important. But the other thing I would say is that I think it's getting harder to deliver like the real epoch shaping stuff like N64. Mm-hmm. Those games were so groundbreaking, you know, stuff like Mario and Zelda on the N64 that, you know, everyone is going to agree that they're a masterpiece. Whereas aside from maybe like a few universally acclaimed games like Galaxy or Galaxy 2, on Wii, you know, look at the other systems. There's not that many games that everyone, you know, agrees is utterly sort of a classic, because it's just harder to define that now because the medium is more advanced. It's less easy to do something that is clearly genre defining or...
Well, and the other part of that is that because the kinds of people who play games are much more diverse now. You know, yep. Gamers as a category now includes virtually every member of the population. It's impossible to make something that virtually all gamers will appreciate, because it's just a more diverse demographic now. You know, so I mean, in 1998, you're not likely to find a gamer who didn't like either Ocarina of Time or Metal Gear Solid or both. And now it wouldn't be hard at all to find somebody who wasn't interested in either of those, but plays plenty of video games.
Yeah, I always look at it like, you know, with Nintendo platforms, I mean, the Nintendo games are sort of, they're always going to be there, right? What's everything else? How's everything else? How's the third-party stuff? That's kind of, to me, what shapes my opinion of a console or a portable. And that's why, to me, the DS is right up there with the Super Nintendo in terms of quality overall.
All right, well, that's the last email. Again, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Now we're going to take a quick break and come back with your retroactive part one on Perfect Dark. Hello, we are back. It's time for Retroactive. This is the 18th Retroactive that we've done. First time in quite a while that we've had a first-person shooter. Of course, the theme was originals and remakes, and you voted in Perfect Dark. It was quite a popular result, quite a popular choice. And as it so happens, I'm glad it worked out this way, we have Greg has been playing the N64 original, which he's mentioned before as being a game that he really loved and that he still busted out every now and then. And the other three of us have been playing it on Xbox 360 in this remade version, which, just for the purposes of those who do not have access to it, the remake on Xbox is very faithful. It's basically a port, with the two changes being that they tightened up the engine so it doesn't have the frame rate problems, and it's more or less in HD, I guess, but it still looks like an N64 game, just
It does look remarkably like an N64 game.
Yeah, because all the models are the same and everything. So, I mean, it is the N64 game, just it looks sharper and it runs smoother. So it's basically being emulated. You know, if you've ever seen an N64 game emulated on a high-end computer, that's kind of what it looks like. It's just really sharp. And the other thing is they added online multiplayer. So it's all the same multiplayer content. I guess the control schemes have different names. Now they're called Duty Calls and Ring or Halo. Or no, it's not Halo, but it's something referencing Halo.
Right.
Instead of Turok and GoldenEye, which is what they used to be based on.
Right.
But all the modes are the same, the guns are the same, the levels are the same, the characters are the same. It's all the same stuff. It's just that if you could play it split screen before, now you can play it full screen online. So you can even do co-op online, which I'm hoping that some of us might get to do for, I don't know if we'll do next week or after E3, but when we do the second part of Retroactive, I hope we'll get to do some of that, because I never got to play the original Perfect Dark co-op, so I want to do that. But anyway, this week we're concentrating on the multiplayer, and by multiplayer I don't mean co-op or counter-op, I mean the deathmatch, basically, and all the different versions of it that you have.
Are they called the combat simulator?
Yeah. Going back, incredibly, incredibly confusing names.
Well, and the incredibly confusing menus.
Right. The menu is a little odd, the way it's set up. But yeah, I mean, this was a huge deal, and you know, I think when Rare was making Perfect Dark in the late 90s, they knew that they had to knock it out of the park with the multiplayer, because this is the spiritual successor to GoldenEye, and GoldenEye had this very surprise hit in the multiplayer. I mean, as we've mentioned before on the show, the multiplayer in GoldenEye was kind of thrown in at the last minute as kind of a bonus. They didn't necessarily expect it to be a major aspect of the game. It was just, hey, we got this working and it's pretty fun. We'll go ahead and include it. So with Perfect Dark, it was clearly a major focus of development. Actually, you could probably argue, and we'll get into this next time when we talk about the campaign, but it probably got a lot more attention than the campaign did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think the defining aspect, and I want to get your impressions, and then we have some forum posts also that we're going to read out. But I think the overall defining characteristic of Perfect Dark multiplayer is that it's so broad. There's so much stuff in it. There's so many options. There's so many guns, so many levels, so many characters, so many little things that you can tweak and set, so many kinds of bots. I mean, just to a really unprecedented level. I don't think any game has come out since that had this many options on the bots, or that had bots that were this good.
Or that had bots in some cases.
Yeah, I mean, not many games come out that even have bots, but usually when they do, you hear people complaining about them and how they're shitty, and, you know, a lot of times they fill in spaces when you play online, and, you know, people wish you could turn that off. You hear that a lot in Brink. Whereas in Perfect Dark, you want to turn on the bots, even if you've got other people to play with, because they just spice it up so much. They're so interesting to play against. They do all these crazy things, you know. And I'm going to come back to this comparison, but I really think it's like the Smash Brothers of first-person shooters.
Yeah.
There is so much stuff. There's so much crazy content. You could mix it all up in a randomizer and get a completely different experience every time you play the game. And that's not really the kind of experience I associate with first-person shooters most of the time.
Yeah. I think the weapons in Perfect Dark are one of the things that, you know, kind of makes it that Smash Brothers type of feel, if you like, because they create a lot of possibilities and a lot of different kinds of games that you can engineer, especially combining them with The Sims and all the kind of team stuff you could do. I mean, certainly, you know, one of the things that I always enjoyed was like the laptop gun and sort of creating fortifications, essentially.
Right.
It just felt like, you know, there was more kind of agency in this compared with GoldenEye, you know, which was really the only first-person shooter multiplayer I'd played before that. I did play a bit of Turok 2 multiplayer.
Which is good.
Yeah, I mean, and that had some pretty goofy, like, weapons in it as well, but I don't think they sort of lent themselves so much to kind of creative use the way that Perfect Dark did. Yeah.
They were more about showing off in Turok.
Well, you can dual wield as well. I mean, which still
you
is
can dual wield almost everything.
Yeah, almost everything. And you really can't do that anymore. I mean, especially I mean, in all of these, you know, like modern warfare and stuff, because they kind of have to strive to be realistic in a way.
Well, beyond that, I think a lot of the newer games like Call of Duty and Halo, they're really concerned with because, again, they want you to keep playing for a long time, and they have these RPG elements in some cases. So they're really concerned about the game being balanced,
yeah.
You know, and they constantly tweak it, and they make certain things more powerful because they want it to all be really balanced. And a lot of that's because you have these loadouts. So they want people to be able to develop different loadouts, you know, to customize different perks and weapons and things that you start with, and to make sure that there are multiple combinations of that that are viable. And in Perfect Dark, you don't have to do that because there are no loadouts. So you can put an obscenely overpowered weapon like the Farsight in the middle of the level, and it's not necessarily unbalanced because everybody has a chance to get it.
Yeah.
Well, unless they spawned right on top of it, which...
It's possible.
Which will inevitably happen if it's a dark sim.
Yeah, but it immediately made me feel like I was playing the first-person shooter version of Smash Brothers, because obviously there's tons of stuff in Smash Brothers that's obscenely unbalanced. They don't even try to balance that game because you can't. There's too many variables. There's too many possibilities. And Perfect Dark's the same way. I mean, there are probably 30 weapons in Perfect Dark. It's just, it's incredible. I mean, we played it for hours and we're still finding weapons that we had never used before in that session, you know, that we'd forgotten were in the game.
Of course, they also have secondary functions as well, yes. Which means that, again, you've got, you know, even within a given weapon, you can have some quite different things, like the laptop gun, of course, like it's kind of like a regular, you know, automatic weapon, but then the secondary function is you throw it onto the wall and it becomes a turret gun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like even stuff like grenades, like I remember having a lot of fun activating the proximity pinball. And, you know, you throw that into a little corner and then you hear the pigging until it's done. Stops and people die.
Yeah. Even your melee attack has an alternate fire where you can disarm people.
Yeah.
And that's really fun because, you know, you've got some your big bad gun, but if someone sneaks up on you or if they just happen to come around the corner and you don't have time to shoot them with your ridiculous gun, then they can just take it from you and then use it on you. So, again, it's unbalanced, and yet they make sure that it's difficult to have some kind of, like, unsurmountable advantage over your opponent. Because the game is so wacky that you just can't take care of every contingency. The other player if he's skilled, if he knows the game, the other player can find some way of getting you out of your little camping position.
And like Smash Brothers, for us at the time, my friends and I, you know, playing it, it was a lot about the comedy of it, you know,
yeah.
The screwing around and creating ridiculous situations. I think I mentioned before about, you know, sort of mining up Sims and ordering them to their death and, you know, all the sorts of, because that's the other thing about the Sims, that the bots, is that not only did you have them, not only did you have a wide variety of them, so it's like, okay, you've got the different difficulty levels and then you've got like behavior traits that are, they're fast or they're, you know, this, that,
Venge
and the other.
Sim.
Yeah, that's the ones that go
that
after
bastard.
The ones that kill them. But also, you could order them about, you know, very specifically. So it's like, okay, you know, if you've got, you know, four Sims on your team or something, you can order this Sim to kill that person and that Sim to kill this person. And, you know, I mean, that level of depth, you know, like, as you said, like, at the time, having Sims in it was a novelty. It's a novelty that's kind of endured because it's not something you saw a lot in first-person shooters or consoles that followed. But the fact that, given that it was groundbreaking, that they went that deep with it,
mm-hmm.
is just really impressive and ambitious and made so many sort of possibilities for screwing around that it did take on Smash Brothers levels of, you know, let's just see what kind of mayhem we can make.
Yeah, and you have to imagine that Rare put a lot of resources into programming these Sims, you know, into developing complex behaviors for them, into stratifying them so much, you know, you have so many different kinds of Sims you can put in there and you can tweak them in various ways. And this was one of the last major big budget first person shooters before online play hit. And I think once the online era really hit, a lot of developers said, well, why would we waste our time making bots when you can just go online and play with people who are even smarter? But
yeah.
What Perfect Dark shows is that it's not necessarily about you not being able to find any friends to play multiplayer, so you play against the bots or with the bots. It's about you and your friends playing with the bots too.
Yeah,
so
and
you
it's
do a
like,
comp
you know,
stomp or you do team ups or whatever, but
it's, you know, partially, you know, trying to outsmart the machines, but then also using the machines to just do funny things to kill your buddies.
For me, one of the fun things to do was to create scenarios with the bots where horrible things happen. So, you know, I've talked about throwing two or three Dark Sims in the room with my cousin and I, and hoping to God that we could stay alive long enough to set up a defensive perimeter. But one of the more fun things to do was put a Dark Sim in and then put like three of the so-called Venge Sims, where they kill the person that killed them. And if the streak keeps going, they keep getting killed by this guy, they get better. And eventually, the Dark Sim would kill these poor Venge Sims so many times, they would become this unrepentant wave of death and just steamroll the poor Dark Sim into a corner and execute him.
So yeah, they became the Dark Sim, essentially. They became the best.
That's crazy.
And basically, as long as you were on the Dark Sim team, they would just run right past you. They didn't give a crap. Like, you didn't kill them. That guy right there has to die. You? I don't care. But if you accidentally shot them, you're screwed. Just leave them alone, let them walk by, but eventually you could talk one of the people you're playing with into shooting them, and then their life would be ruined. There's a sim that just runs around and picks up all the weapons, the pacifist sim. His job is to make it so there's no weapons for anyone to get.
Like, how funny is that? That is just classic.
Like, that guy is an ass, because he'll have the farsight, he'll have the laptop gun, he'll have the proximity mines.
And he's also a walking pinata, because when you kill him, he's just going to explode in
weapons. Yeah, weapons spew everywhere. He doesn't shoot at anybody. He's just got crap. He just has a ton of stuff.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. I mean, that's what was so charming about it, is the fact that, like, you know, Rare wasn't afraid to completely mess with, you know, your typical kill, kill, kill kind of, you know, formula.
Well, when we were playing together online, I think it's the most I've laughed while playing a first-person shooter, maybe since the last time I played it on the N64.
Yeah.
It's just, it's clearly a game that's not meant to be taken seriously, like Smash Brothers. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not going to find people playing Perfect Dark tournaments, ever.
But
it doesn't even make sense. It's not a tournament kind of a game. It wouldn't be fun that way.
I think, in a way, it's kind of more fair than the online games that we have now, because everybody has an equal shot at the weapon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There is a certain amount of luck involved, but if you play enough rounds, it does come down to skill, because everybody's going to get the luck on their side eventually.
Yeah.
And everybody's going to spawn right in the middle of a firefight eventually. It's just the way it is. I mean, if you spawn in the middle of two guys shooting at each other with those double handheld machine guns, you will die before you get control of your character. Yeah, it's going to happen.
You mean the ones with the alternate fire where you lay them on the ground and they become proximity mines that look like weapon pickups?
That's the dragon.
Oh, yeah. That thing
what
is evil.
What a brilliant weapon. I mean, it's like the mystery, it's like the upside down question box in Mario Kart.
I was thinking more like the guns that one of the alternate mode of fire is, you can't stop firing it even if you want to.
Oh, the cyclone where you unload a whole clip in one shot.
So Johnny kills the sim that we're both hunting, but he can't stop and prevent shooting me because he can't stop firing.
Yeah, so I accidentally killed James too. I mean, not my fault, dude. I couldn't.
There's nothing
couldn't
either of us could have done about it at that point. Like as soon as I turned that corner, I was dead.
Yeah, I also enjoyed, you know, chasing after James and just slapping him around for no reason.
Well, and if you hit him in the head, you make him dizzy.
Yeah.
The motion blur. That was like
it's hilarious.
But the problem is, it doesn't go away quickly either. I mean, it's
no, it doesn't. Well, then there's like, isn't there like the one grenade that's like the end bomb, and it just that's what it does? Is it makes you dizzy?
To the extreme, though, I haven't unlocked that in my
Xbox
copy.
You can barely see anything if you
so
really get caught.
It's funny, yeah, because it just turns. It's like you just did 20 tequila shots. Like the screen put this insane shader over it, and you turn really slowly, and you kind of see everything in the slideshow. It's so funny.
Well, there's that one challenge. The challenges start out really easy, and we blaze through them. But there's this one challenge we got to that was slow motion combat, and the challenge is exactly that. Everybody's walking at a very slow pace, and the guns fire really slowly.
And so you're like, a motherfucker.
Pretty much. I mean, it's so slow that the team to win only has to score 3 points, and you get a point for killing an enemy.
Yeah, and it still takes 10 minutes. I mean, it's hilarious.
What's amusing about it is there's a grenade launcher alternate mode weapon in that stage, so you'll see the grenade slowly bounce.
Oh yeah,
you.
No, this
and
is bringing back memories.
There's nothing you can fucking do about it.
Yeah, you can't. Like, you can see it, but you can't move fast enough to actually get out of the way.
You're moving just as slow as that grenade, and So when I played it single player, I had more luck than when we played it multiplayer, I guess because Johnny's just that bad. I don't know.
No, it's because they increased the sims and everything.
No, I mean this goes again to what Johnny was saying about how much effort they put in, that they created these challenges for the combat simulator part of the game that, you know, weren't even necessarily multiplayer. Like, you could do them on your own.
They're the events from Melee and Brawl.
Yeah, they're kind of like that, but you can also do them co-op or, you know.
Right, and they weren't even, like, featured. They were just kind of in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like, at the time, like, when I had the game, I wasn't really thinking about them at all. I thought a reason to be excited. Excited, but I ended up getting quite a lot of fun out of them. And I mean, as you said, they could be, I think they generally were more difficult on with friends a lot of the time, you know, because they scaled up with the number of players, and therefore, you know, you kind of needed to be coordinated and stuff, that we weren't necessarily a well-oiled machine as a team. But there was one I remember having tremendous fun with. It's the level where I can't remember exactly what it's called. It might be Fortress, but you've got the four coloured bases that are multi-leveled.
Oh yeah.
And so it's a briefcase scenario. Right, so you're trying to capture the case and bring it back. And so we were, you know, trying to mount this assault on a base that's just loaded with sims, and you've got lifts on either side of the top level. Like, we always went through the top, not the bottom. And so what we do is have two people stand over the lift and just, we would quote unquote smoke them out, which was
thanks Arnie,
pump in grenades,
pump iron,
flood it with grenades, and then after that we'd all go in and just, you know, try and pick over the bones, get the case and get out. And, you know, that just trying to coordinate that disaster half the time the grenade would, you know, trying to shoot down the lift and it would just bounce up off the roof and
it would
then
just
everyone
back
was dead
in your head.
And, you know, it was hilarious.
That stage in particular always made me think of playing paintball or laser tag. It really has that kind of that feel to it, and the way it's designed, you know, in that, you know, there's this base and there's only a couple ways into it. You kind of have to coordinate these weird assaults with your friends to try to get in there, and you know some of you will die.
Yeah, you gotta give it up for the team.
I mean, there was a level that one of the ways I used to handle it was when I would play it with friends, I would always just toss the laptop gun secondary mode down the chute. And I would know they were all hanging out down there waiting for me because I could see it on radar. So once the laptop gun landed down there, suddenly all their radar dots disappeared. But I couldn't see it. I could hear it, but it was so far down I couldn't actually see what was going on. I just knew they all got smoked.
You could have shot that remote control missile down there.
Yeah, and then they could
have fly-by-wire, that is hilarious.
And then they could have slowly sidestepped out of the way of it.
Yeah. I mean, that is a real problem for screen watching, though. And it makes that, like, noise as well. Everyone knows it's going to be coming, so I guess if it could be going for multiple targets is one thing, but right. Still, it's another case of, like, they did put so many weapon ideas in it, you know, they had, like, the gun that could shoot through walls, the gun that's a sentry gun, the gun that's fly-by-wire rockets, it's just everything, complete smorgasbord of destruction.
The sentry gun, to me, is kind of the weirdest weapon, because people will just leave it in these places where you can't see it.
Often, you know, if you're just playing a kind of standard deathmatch, you're trying to rack up kills, you put it in the thoroughfare. If there's a part of a level where generally people are going to have to cross through to get a weapon, or there's a good drop there or whatever, you put it there and let it reap the dividends.
So what I find amusing about this... first off, can you mix like two players local and then multiplayers online?
That's a really good question. I mean, as we established last week, I don't have a second controller. So
yeah,
I mean,
that's the thing,
that, though.
That is a general point. I would love that sort of multiplayer. Like, right, that combines local with online, you know. So, like, I mean, it had a little bit of this, actually, on Wii with, like, Mario Strikers Charts, where you could be a team of two playing online against another team of two.
You can do it in Brawl, I think. If you can get online. Now, you could definitely do it in Mario Kart Wii, which is one of the best things about that game.
I was trying to remember what this challenge I was looking up was, and this is where bots are actually kind of good, kind of bad, is that sometimes the bots seem overly determined to complete their objective, and sometimes they don't seem to particularly care what the game's objective is. So in the grid with Devastators, So the grid is like this big lobby to a business office.
Yeah, with the one with the elevator and the glass floor.
Yeah. And the Devastator immediately destroys the glass floor. It's about the least accurate weapon in the world. And the problem is, like, the AI just doesn't care about holding the case in that particular level, which is the objective. They just want to blow you up with the freaking Devastator.
So they're griefing you.
Pretty much. Because they don't care as long as you don't hold the case.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of bizarre, whereas we had that one challenge where the AI was, like, singularly determined.
Oh, well, yeah, so it was the King of the Hill mode, which is just the interface for that whole thing's obtuse. You have to know the level extremely well in order to play that effectively.
Or be able to teleport like them.
Yeah, and yeah, James and I were playing this challenge together. It was brutally difficult, because it was on that... What's the name of that level? Is it the Complex?
Something like that.
It's the one with a lot of ramps, and in GoldenEye there were a lot of false walls. Some of those are removed in the Perfect Dark version. But it's a very vertical level. It's also really complexly laid out, so there's a lot of sort of dead ends, and even sometimes the marker for the hill that you're trying to capture is right on the other side of a wall, but you can't get over there. You have to go way around to go through some corridor to get up to the other side of the wall.
You have to go down and up, then back down, then back up. And
so if you don't know that level inside and out, it's probably one of the most difficult levels to play King of the Hill on, because this zone that you need to stand in moves around constantly. So you have to know exactly how to get to every single part of the map. And James and I were playing it against it, and these two Sims were jacked up something crazy. They were really powerful. They were super fast. And they always stuck together.
Right.
Because James and I were spreading out so that one of us could find the zone, because we were having trouble navigating the map. So we always split up. Oh, I found it. And then the other would try to get over there and usually fail. Whereas these bots both knew exactly where to go, so they always stayed together. So it was always one against two whenever we did run across them.
Right.
And, and plus they always got to the zone first because they were much faster than us. So it was always them defending a fortified position and us trying to assault it and failing miserably.
Trying to assault it one on two.
We just got our asses beat. I mean,
and what was funny
brutal.
About that challenge was there was an incident where Johnny and I were on the hall trying to get to the zone and they weren't there either. And they just ran right by us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they didn't even try to engage us. We're shooting at them. They just keep running.
Yep.
but once we got near that zone, they went apeshit on us. And there was nothing we could do to stop them.
It's A or B for those guys. But again, notice the part in James' story where we're going towards the goal and they come up from behind us and run past us and beat us to the goal because they are so much faster. I mean, that is unfair.
I guess. They probably have to have a bit of, you know, blunt force in terms of the AI, you know, to achieve the kinds of ends they wanted, because I'm sure it wasn't, you know, it's the Xbox version, but I'm sure it's based, you know, as you said, it's very faithful to the N64.
Oh, yes.
And you know, you're not going to have incredibly nuanced AI on the N64.
Still, it is kind of nice, though, after, like, you know, dealing with so much crappy AI, actually having AI that kicks your ass. To some degree, you're kind of like,
it really feels good when you kill one of these guys. It's quite an achievement.
Well, that was the same playthrough where Johnny was running from the AI, and I was about two rooms ahead of him. and they gunned him down while in pursuit. And he basically is telling me just to keep running.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't stop. Just keep
don't
running.
Don't stop. Well, they're going to get me. You go ahead.
And they didn't just catch me. They came out of a corridor in front of me and gunned me down. I'm like, how did that even happen?
They took a shortcut, I guess.
Yeah, like, I mean, we had to turn them down when we played.
It was like something out of a horror movie. It really was.
I'm thinking, like, I've made a clean break. There's nothing they can do to stop. Oh, God. Oh, no.
And then Jason steps out from around the corner.
Like, I just heard the guns start blazing. I'm like, I'm done. And then there they were right in front of me. Oh, you bastards.
And they always had the best weapons. I'm sitting there trying to kill them with a tranquilizer by just, like, lethal injection stabbing them, you know?
But my gun has a silencer on it, I swear. And a laser sight.
They've got, like, a tank strapped to their arm, and they're just blowing up everything. And you're just thinking to yourself, I can't survive here.
Yeah. So let's get into some of the user comments. First off, Dropkick posted, Personally, I was late to the party with Perfect Dark. I first played it at a friend's house, and he tried to show me the single-player game. Many months later, my older brother rented it, as he had heard the multiplayer was better than GoldenEyes. Sure enough, it was better, and I still pull out the N64 every couple of years to play against the bots with friends. The only thing that would make the multiplayer perfect would have been the inclusion of GoldenEyes' Moonraker Laser.
Oh, no.
I forgot that was in there.
It's got like the little waffle grill on top of it.
Wow. Yeah, it's
silly. I'd totally forgotten about that. To this day, I've never played more than 10 minutes of the single-player campaign. It remains the only game in my collection I own solely for the multiplayer. Fuck Halo, give me the laptop gun, and Farsight any day over the Nerf toys Halo uses.
Yeah, it's certainly definitely different than Halo, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. It has a completely different feel.
Yeah, it's entirely different. Much faster, much more in the vein of something like Time Splitters.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Well, yeah, obviously, but
it's made by a lot of the same people. Yeah,
yeah, another first-person series that I miss dearly and wish would come back.
I do think Perfect Dark is better than any of the Time Splitters.
Yeah.
The funny thing about the weapons of Perfect Dark is they dared to be way overpowered.
Yeah.
Like, about half the guns in the game are just patently unfair if the other person has them.
Mm-hmm.
But they just don't care.
Right. Yeah, it's that Smash Brothers mentality of, we're gonna put the soccer ball in here. We're gonna give one person the invincibility star. We're gonna drop this tomato.
Let's see what happens. That's kind of the motto of the game.
I love it. I think it's a fantastic attitude.
Well, I guess, I mean, kind of on the dark side of the whole weapons thing. Like, we've got this post from Adadad. He was talking about the multiplayer challenges getting more difficult. And he said that struggling through these challenges reminds me of the main reason why, as a child coming off years of GoldenEye, trying Perfect Dark at a friend's house left me somewhat cold, although not unimpressed. I dislike the fact that if you get caught by someone with a good automatic gun, you're dead almost instantly before you can even have a chance to realise what's going on. This makes it more satisfying for the killer, and it's cool to get the drop on someone and kill them before they can even get a shot at you, but it feels though it leaves the automatic weapons like the laptop gun feeling too much like powerful explosive weapons, so that pistols are too weak to compete. So, I mean, I guess that's kind of what James is talking about in terms of, like, it does, they feel almost like unfair. There isn't really competition. I guess, like, GoldenEye, you could do some damage with pistols.
Yeah.
Whereas, to be honest, I don't think, you know, because of the hijinks and the comedy element of Perfect Dark, I don't think there was a lot of pistol usage of any description.
There's so many pistols in the game. I mean, I haven't had time to try all of them, but there has to be at least one or two power. I mean, there's the magnums, they're hard to aim, but if you hit somebody with them, they will kill.
Yeah,
especially if you have two double magnums, you could deal some damage out there.
Yeah. No, I would give that. They're very slow though. So I mean, and you know, like with the frame rate on the N64, spray weapons were preferable because
that's true. That's been fixed in the remake.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a big difference there, you know, because especially like if you do have a lot of sims on, which, you know, you'd be inclined to do because it's more fun that way, the performance is a struggle. And, you know, aiming is kind of a casualty of that. And so, again, it definitely lent itself more to the comical spray and pray antics rather than like, oh, I'm going to be like some assassin type with a magnum.
Well, I think a large part of my love for Perfect Dark goes back to it being one of the first dorm games, really one of the only dorm games that I had, because I lived in the dorm for 2 years. The first year was in 2000, so obviously I'd gotten Perfect Dark the summer, really right around when I graduated from high school, because it came out in May of 2000, and so I'd been playing it all summer by myself mostly. And then I got to college and I had a dorm room, and all of a sudden, it was not hard to find four people to play video games. And Perfect Dark was, and I wonder if you guys remember this, when you introduced it to people, it was, everybody was like, Perfect Dark, what the hell is that? And then once I showed it to them and I said, it's just GoldenEye, but better, they were on it, you know, like crack.
Yeah, like, oh, okay.
Because I think Nintendo really did not do a great job marketing it, or maybe it was the fact that it came out in May. You know, or that it came out, I mean, summertime, not a great, you know, right at the beginning of summer is not necessarily a great time to release a video game. Certainly at that time it was unusual, but all these people, and also maybe they were more casual gamers who had picked up GoldenEye through word of mouth the same way. you know.
Yeah.
So they were familiar with GoldenEye, but they had no idea that Perfect Dark was somehow associated with GoldenEye.
Right.
And which was difficult for Nintendo to convey because it was unlicensed and, you know, for because of copyright issues, it didn't have the same content. But once they figured it out, I mean, we played a lot of Perfect Dark, and I remember one of my favorite things was to set up a match in which we pretty much tried to break the system. Like, we just tried to just drown the N64 in processing. So we would set up with all these sims. It was full of N-bombs and also basically rocket launchers and grenades, you know, like just try to fill the screen with explosions and slow motion with as many people on screen as possible in the most complicated level. And we would just try to get it down to, like, one frame per second, you know. We just tried to, like, slideshow it. It was so funny.
Yeah. So you tried to play Winback is what you're telling me.
Well, that's what really amazed me when I first put the game in. I was like, wow, pretty much what this, I mean, you didn't even really have to play the game that much to realize that what they were allowing you to set up was well beyond what the N64 could do. I mean, I really can't believe they shipped the game the way they shipped it, but the way they shipped it was awesome because they just obviously didn't care. They wanted to stuff as much stuff in as possible. Performance be damned.
Well, I mean, they really did push it from the point of view, like, it used the expansion pack, and it was on the barest margin of absolutely needing it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, technically it didn't. They could say that. So, like, I think you could do, like, a one-on-one death match or something.
Yes,
just
you could play two-player split screen. You could play the challenges. And that's about it. You couldn't play the single-player campaign. You couldn't do four-player split screen. A lot of the levels and things and were shut off.
I believe, because I have, you know, I've been playing the original copy, I have the box, and it's got a little tick chart of you can do and can't do. And I believe it says that you can access 35% of the game without the expansion pack, and I really think that number is padded.
It is.
because, I mean, you really do need it. And then even with the expansion pack, which, you know, was certainly something that, you know, a lot of high profile N64 games used, you know, Majora's Mask, Donkey Kong 64 and stuff. So, you know, it wasn't the only one, but
that's the strange thing. I'm surprised that they didn't just require it, because you had Donkey Kong 64 came out in 1999 and that game included the expansion pack. So, if you were, you know, if you followed Rare Games or Nintendo published games, then you would have already had one anyway. And then by the time Perfect Dark came out, maybe not at the time they decided they made this decision to include some content for people who didn't have it, but by the time it came out, it was known that Majora's Mask would require it too. And I think some versions of Majora's Mask included it, maybe.
There's probably a bundle of some sort.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is,
probably,
though, it may have been an approach of, like, look, maybe they'll buy it, they'll play some one-on-one deathmatch, and then think, God, you know, we want to do the rest of it now. And so, you know, maybe just if it lowered the barrier to entry a little bit, you know, got sort of a gateway drug type of thing going on. Because, as you said, GoldenEye had a lot of crossover kind of appeal, a lot of casual fans.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were hoping that those people were then going to jump onto Perfect Dark, which, you know, as you kind of described, maybe that was a bit of a stretch in the end.
Yeah,
but
it was. I think they overestimated how popular this game would be.
If they were hoping for that, then they might be thinking, well, these are the kinds of people that didn't buy Donkey Kong 64, and, they, you know, they're not going to have an expansion pack, so let's give them, let's throw them a bone, get them through the door, and then maybe they'll go out and pick it up to literally expand the experience.
Well, so actually we have a forum post that references some of these performance problems we've been talking about. So Oh Boy posted,
yeah, more O's.
If I was to find and plug everything back in, I would find that I blew hundreds of hours on this game. While I can no longer excuse the frame rate, at the time I just didn't care when playing with four players and eight fist sims with shotguns or Comedy Gold sedative gun only matches. Those are fun. This and GoldenEye in their time were two perfect games on an imperfect system. It's a shame that Rare has lost the magic since. And by the way, Rare hasn't just lost the magic, they've lost most of the people who actually made GoldenEye and Perfect Dark.
I think my favorite Rare thing of recent times was that there was a Kinect associated trademark that had, like, googly eyes in the title.
Yes.
And I was looking at Eurogamer And so at first it's just like, oh, mystery trademark involving googly eyes. And then later on, if you looked at the tagline, it just said update, thought to be connected to Rare. And it's like, wow, I would never have called that one googly eyes or Rare. I think they really are firmly into that, you know, grabbed by the ghoulies, piling up in the trash bin, like trolling themselves mode.
Right, they've really sort of turned the corner on that. And I mean, they really started it with Conker when they started putting googly eyes on paint cans and rakes. I mean, yeah, at that point, they were just being facetious about it.
Well, and there's the toilet in Banjo-Tooie.
Locker. The Locker. Legend.
Oh, what a great name.
Yeah, so I think probably the thing that Rare has retained is its quintessentially British ability to be self-deprecating. Unfortunately, yeah. the rest of the stuff seems to have gone.
Right, it's only funny if you're actually good at something.
Yeah, but you're kind of picking over the flaws.
Otherwise, it's just tragic. So we've got some more forum posts here. So let me get to one from Gojira.
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 I can't talk about Perfect Dark without saying a bit about GoldenEye first. Even though I'm not a fan of the FPS genre, I did enjoy GoldenEye quite a bit and played through the single player multiple times, but I didn't get to play much of the multiplayer. So then totally flipped that with Perfect Dark. Other than the first level, I probably only played through the game once. It was all about the multiplayer for me. I didn't all of a sudden get gamer friends, but I did make great use of the bots. I love playing King of the Hill with a certain loadout of bots and weapons. I love the laptop gun and double maulers. Having such great memories of Perfect Dark, I bought the HD port on XBLA right away. I played through the single player on the lowest level, and it was okay. But I had zero desire to play any multiplayer since I've had so much more fun in other better games recently.
Yeah, so that's a bit of a contrarian sort of opinion from what you guys were saying playing it.
But he said he didn't even try the multiplayer. He had zero desire. And I guess from our experience, I would say if you've already bought it on Xbox, you really should get some people together and play it online. You might find that it's actually better than you remember and totally worth your time. At this point, I would rather, if I had a choice of what to play, if I had people online to play with, and we just had this stack of things that we all own, and I'm gonna pick one, at this point, based on the past week's experiences, I would probably rather spend that time on Perfect Dark than on, you know, Modern Warfare 2.
Well, it's just stupid fun.
But also, it could be, like, complimentary, because it is different.
True. It's almost a different genre. Like, yeah, you run around in first person shooting people, but, yeah, I mean, it is... It's a completely different experience. So, yeah, you could do both.
Although it's interesting, some of these experiences, obviously this is the multiplayer centric component of our retroactive on it, but how many people are talking about not playing the single player? Like, what is it going to be like when we do this, the next part of this feature? Like, is this going to be like, this game had a single player? I had no idea.
Well, I know we're not talking about the single player right now, but I did have one observation that it's salient to the multiplayer. Which is that the game operates, and I talked about this in the forums, on the theory of volume of fire, where I'm going to increase the difficulty astronomically by just upping the amount of gunfire in the general vicinity of your body. And the bots will do this by basically having three bots spray and pray on you. But in the game, there's a level, I think it's like the third level, Chicago, where there's this fucking robot that goes around and just shoots you.
Oh yeah, it's like a Dalek that when it speaks to you.
It's not like it's based on you having a gun out or anything. It just sees you and starts shooting.
I remember that level. It's like, oh, I get it. I'm supposed to blend in with the city, and then I want to shoot. Nah, it just shoots at you.
But what I always thought was funny about this level, and I observed this the other day, is that the spray and pray mentality of that bot, and for another example, is the helicopter in the very first level.
Oh, yeah.
Is that they fill the game with so much firepower that they will often end up killing other enemies simply by merit of the fact that they're shooting everything in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll kill each other trying to get to you.
It's both amusing and horrifying, I have to say.
Which, that happens with human behavior too, though. I mean, we already described a situation in which I accidentally killed James because I was trying to get the bots with the most effective weapons. So it works both ways.
Yeah.
Well, my plea to Gojira is come online and play with us. and I bet you'll have a really good time.
Yeah.
Don't dismiss it out of hand. It is really, really fun. And, you know, again, it supports split screens, so if you can just get some people over and find the controllers, you can totally play the old school way too, even though it's on Xbox. It is a really good remake. I'm impressed with it. And it's $10. And unfortunately, Perfect Dark's not available. I mean, the N64 version is not on Virtual Console. It won't be.
And it wouldn't be nearly as good anyways. I prefer the 360 one to the N64 one.
You would, you hater.
It's a better port. I mean, it's improved it.
Yeah, it is. I mean,
it's the same game with a couple of improvements, you know. So yeah. I think it's pretty much a strictly better game. There might be a couple, you know, purists might have a couple of arguments against that, but if there's anything that's worse about it, I don't remember it or don't notice it. I think it's a strictly better version of it, and it's cheap. So, if you have access to it, I'd say play it. But again, obviously, as Greg's proven, there's nothing wrong with the original if you've still got that lying around.
I've pulled over the past decade. It's still, you know, because it's something, you know, when you see old friends or whatever, you know, it's something that's salient to you. You know, it's a lot easier to just drop back into that than it is to, like, learn a new game or something. And, you know, in terms of, as we've said, in terms of local multiplayer shooting fun, you know, it's still right up there as far as I can tell. I'm not obviously an avid fan of the genre to, you know, speak about that with any great authority.
Well, let's pose that to John, because John keeps up with the
state of
the art.
John keeps up with the kids.
Yeah.
He keeps up with the state of the art of the genre more than we do. So, John, what are your kind of general thoughts on how this game holds up and how it compares to what's out there now?
Well, I think it holds up really well, just because, especially on Xbox Live Arcade, just how quick the gameplay is. I mean, you know, you have kind of different types of shooters out there, like Modern Warfare is also very, very quick. Halo, a little bit slower, kind of more
plotting.
Yeah.
Vehicles.
Yeah, exactly. There's more vehicles involved. Unreal Tournament is more of like a Twitch shooter. And it kind of reminds me of, it's kind of a throwback to like Quake and those kind of simpler, first person shooters from that time period, like late 90s.
I used to play Quake 3 online with Evan Birchfield. Actually, I didn't own it. We both had the demo when the demo first came out. And it was a multiplayer demo, because that was a multiplayer-only game, pretty much.
Yep.
Right.
Although it did have bots, Quake 3.
Yeah.
I really had a good time with it. But even then, you know, I thought Perfect Dark was more fun than Quake 3.
Yeah.
And there's certainly a lot more you can do in Perfect Dark. There's so much more variety. There's so much more choice in how you set up matches and stuff like that.
Yep, and I think that's part of the real appeal. And, you know, the reason why the game is still worth playing now is just because there's so many things that you can do now that, because the way that things were tackled with Perfect Dark and kind of the way things were, you know, there wasn't, you know, online didn't influence every single part of its design. You know, it was geared towards getting people into a room, like we talked about the party genre now. Because it was geared towards that rather than entirely geared towards funneling people towards the online portion of it and playing against people online by themselves. You know, there's just a lot more things. There's a very unique flavor to the gameplay that you're not going to find in any first-person shooter that's made now.
Yeah, actually, we have a note related to that from the forums. So Mop It Up posted, "The AI bots in the multiplayer is something that more shooters these days need to have. I don't like to play games competitively, so I would always team up with my friends to take on a horde of simulants. Sure, online shooters let you team up with friends to challenge the world, but they have to play on their own systems. We can't go online from just one. Also, some of the people who played online spend way too much time playing and are impossibly good, which is no fun. If anything, bots are needed more than ever so that people can have some beatable opponents to practice the game with in an offline setting. I enjoy Perfect Dark because of what would be considered simplicity by today's gaming crowd. It provides straight-up shooty-shooty action without any of the contrived features and tactical nonsense that make modern shooters too complex and slow to be any fun."
Yeah, I guess it's an interesting point with the bots, in terms of that you can use them, you know, to just tailor the kind of difficulty, you know, and ease yourself in, you know, at your own discretion. Because, as we said, there's a lot of, you know, you've got, what is it, like, you've got at the very bottom, like, meat sims, and then easy, normal, hard, perfect, dark. I mean, there's a lot of increments there, quite apart from like all the wacky behavior ones, that you could tailor exactly what kind of opposition you want to face and to just scale that up as you get better at the game. You know, you can't control that in the same way if you're just playing actual people, really. You know, certainly I've seen no evidence of matchmaking that's effective enough to, you know, achieve a similar result.
Yeah, no, I mean, even if you start out playing the same game at the same time, I mean, some people just get better at games.
Quicker.
Yeah.
The other exciting thing I think about having all these different levels of Sims, even apart from the quirky behavior ones, is that if you change the difficulty of the Sims, it actually changes how they behave. So it's not just moving meters in terms of how much damage they do and how much they can take and how fast they turn and stuff like that, although all that happens. I mean, it was well known even at the time that Dark Sims actually react to things faster than a human can possibly do it. They had made them so that they were better than any human player could possibly be.
Right, so you really had to get the drop on a Dark Sim.
Right, you almost had to be, there was an element of luck in killing them. But also strategy too, like James said. I mean, you can set up scenarios in which you have a chance to kill them, but they are superhuman, literally.
From a game story standpoint, they are meant to be superhuman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they are literally like clones or something, created for the sake of some whatever the hell. I mean, I don't even remember what Datadyne is trying to accomplish. I just remember there's an alien,
More on that next time.
Yeah. I guess like we'll all be reminded of that soon.
They're literally meant to be God, essentially. They're near psychic in their reaction time.
Yeah, I mean, there might be a bit of input reading going on. I don't know.
Oh, there definitely was.
Like Psychomantis?
Yeah, Psychomantis.
Only it'd be like Psychomantis could also dodge all your shots.
Yeah.
And all the Controller 2 shots as well.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I think what Mop It Up said about the simplicity, I would pose that a different way, because actually if you start messing around with all the options, there's actually a lot of complexity. Like I said before, there's tons of variables that you can set here to make the game very complicated. So I don't know if I would say simplicity, but I would say transparency. Because, you know, one of the things about the modern online shooter is you get in there and the other players might be using perks and weapons that you don't even know are in the game. So you can die in ways that are inexplicable to the new player, you know, and that's very frustrating when you feel like, well, I was shooting at that guy, why didn't he die?
Yeah, imagine if the Farsight was something you had to unlock.
Yeah, by playing the game for 20 hours, and the new people aren't allowed to use it. And that is really frustrating. In those games, there's a lot of stuff going on in the background, and with the structure of the game, with the things other people are unlocking and earning, that make it so that it can seem really arbitrary. You know, I mean, a very common complaint you get with Call of Duty, and I had the same thing the first time I played it online, is I just spawned and I died and I don't know why. And I just kept spawning. I just kept dying in 3 seconds. I never had a chance to do anything. I didn't even know where I was going or what I was supposed to be doing. The game is so complex, and yet a lot of that stuff is hidden from you in various ways. And in Perfect Dark, there's a lot of stuff to do, there's a lot of things you can set up, but it's all transparent. It's an option that you can set.
I mean, the first time you encounter, like, the Farsight, you might go, what the hell was that?
It's a laboratory, though, is what I'm saying. I mean, it's really up to you to set all that stuff up and control it and then go and enjoy it, you know? And so part of the fun is mixing up all these weird combinations of guns and levels and bots and players and seeing what happens, you know, and then you can totally reproduce that. We used to keep a sheet where we wrote down weapon combinations, weapon loadouts. And when I say loadout here, it's the loadout for the level, not for each player.
Yeah.
But we actually had playlists, you know, that we made of like the most fun weapon combinations to set up. So we, you know, there was this ritual when we sat down to play Perfect Dark, we had the 4 controllers and I went in there and I knew every single option to set the way I wanted it to for the maximum crazy. And that really doesn't happen anymore, I don't think. That's a pretty special thing.
I'm guessing once they were available, Dark Sims were often involved in the maximum crazy.
Often.
Because, I mean, it could be one of them set against a herd of fist Sims. And what will invariably happen is, like, they'll all try to swarm around it and punch it to death. And then it just goes all Matrix on them with Attack 9. And you're like, well, that just happened.
All right, well, I think the last forum post that we have for this week is from Lolmanade. And he wrote, I've plugged a few hours into playing some of the challenges and a match or two with the bots, and the graphics are actually better than I expected. The maps seem very tight and deliberate in their design, as opposed to what I've seen in the current-gen FPS I've played, Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare, where a lot of them seem like a series of large open rooms. I didn't notice any considerable slowdown, although I didn't play a match with more than three players, and if memory serves correctly, the heavy frame rate drops don't occur until there are at least five characters in a match. I think there are two main differences between Perfect Dark and modern first-person shooter multiplayer. Number one, RPG elements. I experienced this problem firsthand when I got Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare a few years after the game came out for PS3. I began multiplayer with a big handicap, not only due to the disparity in skill, but also due to them having an unfair advantage in weapons, armor, and skill upgrades. Two, departure from split-screen multiplayer. The best part of Perfect Dark multiplayer is that you are sitting with your friends playing the game. My best memories are playing this game with my friend, putting a cardboard divider between the screens to prevent screen watchers, and both of us pitting ourselves against as many sims as we could withstand.
Yeah, that's the whole screen divider thing is made feasible really by the vertical split, which is a nice option that this has, especially if you play in widescreen, which I've done.
I don't think GoldenEye had a vertical split, did it?
No, it didn't. And a lot more, like, modern games don't have vertical split that you really think would, you know, well, I should say more modern games that came after it. That was a nice touch there that definitely made that I didn't do screen dividing or anything. I know people who did. For this and for Halo, I think, as well.
I just never heard of the phenomenon until, like, 2005. And I was like, hey, you put cardboard on your... What are you, an idiot?
Well, yes.
For us, it was just all so dopey that the idea that one could cheat at Perfect Dark is ridiculous.
It's not that competitive in the first place. So.
Exactly. You know, it's all a bit of a laugh. So, you know, I mean, maybe... You know, sometimes just the screen watching was part of the game, or other times you were just too busy dicking around to pay any attention to what was going around.
So, the funny thing about the dividers, and I've never seen these in person, but I remember seeing advertisements for them, is that there was some company marketing this super deluxe screen divider that used a series of mirrors in addition to the divider, so that you could actually sort of position yourself around... Sort of maybe in a hemisphere, like a half circle around the TV, and the mirrors would redirect your quarter of the display so that the other person couldn't even like tilt their head over to see it. Like it was really showing the screen in four different angles.
That sounds like the worst product ever made.
Yeah, I mean, but that's how popular these games were, GoldenEye and Perfect Dark, is that there was actually this kind of market, you know, and it certainly wasn't. It was well known that people use dividers. That was very common knowledge. You know, maybe you didn't do it with your friends, but you knew you'd heard about people doing it. You know,
I hadn't until
2005.
Yeah.
On the subject of the level design, I guess finally, I mean, I did feel like, you know, like levels like the one I talked about earlier with the lifts and the, you know, the four bases and all. I do feel like seemed like there was definitely more thought put into levels that would work in different kinds of multiplayer scenarios. You know, I mean, I think you kind of what you said about King of the Hill in the complex, like maybe that wasn't so great there, but there was definitely levels where it was probably better suited to that and ones that were good for, like, you know, capturing the case and all this. Like, you know, with GoldenEye, you know, again, probably because it wasn't nearly the same kind of focus of it, it was definitely, like, fun levels. And, you know, I mean, I like the facility and the complex they brought over, for instance, but, you know, with that, they didn't feel like they had thought so much about specific scenarios, and they were much more just, like, kind of lifted out of bits of the single-player levels and stuff, which still happens here.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more stuff. It just feels like, yeah, there was specific design that went into these.
Well, I think it helps that there's just so many of them. I mean, there's got to be at least 20 levels in Perfect Dark. And show me a modern first-person shooter with 20 levels in multiplayer. Maybe after you buy all three map packs for DLC for an additional $45.
That may or may not already be on the disc.
And yeah, the levels are a lot bigger because they support 16 or 32 players, but they're not necessarily more fun. And the other thing is, in a lot of modern first-person shooters, basically there are levels for Capture the Flag, and that's the only mode that you can actually play on that, you know, like there are levels that are designed for deathmatch, and then there are levels that are designed for vehicle combat, and they're all segregated like that, you know. So if you play a different mode, now you're playing on a different level. Team Fortress 2 is really bad about that, because the modes are so specific that, you know, there's a mode and there's only two maps for that mode. Because that's all they've designed. And Perfect Dark, I like that you can create all these crazy alchemies of modes and levels, and some of them maybe don't work and aren't that much fun, but it's up to you to find the ones that are.
Yeah.
It is a shame that the remake isn't available on Wii, for instance. It's a shame that this game isn't on Virtual Console, so it's, you know, easier to find. But I think Perfect Dark is absolutely worth tracking down. I mean, especially if you're one of the many people who love GoldenEye and for whatever reason never played Perfect Dark, and there are millions of people like that,
yeah.
Then you absolutely need to check this out. I mean, if you liked multiplayer in GoldenEye, you need to play Perfect Dark, because the multiplayer is better.
Yeah, I would also encourage people that perhaps have only grown up with, you know, Modern Warfare and those kinds of first-person shooters and really don't consider themselves first-person shooter fans at all. Like, they're just like, that's just not for me. I'm not one of those, you know, macho hardcore, you know, they don't think they're part of that kind of crowd. If you don't really like those kinds of first-person shooters, give Perfect Dark a try, because it's a very different beast.
Yeah, although we should issue the warning that if you're playing it on Xbox... You may have difficulty finding random opponents. I tried it a couple times and couldn't find anyone. So I think when the game, the remake came out over a year ago, I think if people are still playing it at this point, they're playing it with their private groups. So, you know, trade your gamer tags with us, set up something on the forum, either in the retroactive thread or down the line, you know, just make a separate thread and try to get people together and plan a time to play it together online. Cause it's probably not a game that you're going to be able to jump in and fill up a game with random people.
Yeah.
And you probably wouldn't want to anyway.
No.
Actually, the last thing I want to say about it is that, I think this is a game that I will come back to and play more of. And that's not always the case with retroactive. A lot of times I have good intentions of coming back and finishing Ogre Battle or whatever. Maybe I never will, just because we got to move on to the next thing. But now that I've had a taste of playing some Perfect Dark multiplayer with you guys, it's something I would like to set up on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Maybe
I mean,
just one night a month. Yo, let's get together, crack open a few beers and play some Perfect Dark. I would love that. I really would. But yeah, we're going to have to wrap it up for this week, so thanks everybody who participated, and I hope we've convinced some of you who aren't playing along to start, and we're going to come back. You know, I think for the campaign, it would be better if we wait till after E3 and talk about the single-player campaign of Perfect Dark, which could include the co-op and counter-op modes, which are really interesting, and hopefully I'll be able to play with James and John online for some of that, because I've never really played counter-op for more than about half of the first level, probably.
No, me neither.
And I've never really... The co-op was so brutally slowdown-ridden in the N64 that it was just kind of painful to play it. So I think that'll be a lot better now. But anyway, the campaign for Perfect Dark is a very interesting topic. It's going to be more controversial for sure than this multiplayer stuff was. And we're going to get a lot of mixed emotions and mixed opinions on it, I think, from ourselves and from you in the forum thread. So if you are playing along or if you're about to start, be sure to hit up the retroactive forum thread. Leave your comments there. We will read some of those on the show next time. And it's also a good place to set up some online multiplayer matches if you want to do that. I'm totally fine with you using that space to do so.
I'm not.
We're also, and the Facebook page is another good way to do that. We've been trying to set up some of that this week, and we'll continue to. So, you know, post your gamer tag if you want to play some Xbox version up there, and we'll try to coordinate that as well. So the address for that is facebook.com/radiofreenintendo. Of course, for the forum thread, just go to nintendoworldreport.com and go to the forums, and you'll find it under podcast discussion. Or you can go to the article for this episode, and there'll be a link there. Very convenient. There's a lot of other good reasons to go to the article, because we have links to all the games that we talk about on the episodes, and there's a contact form there. So if you can't remember the email address for some reason, you can click on a link there and just type it into the website, so that's easier. And, of course, check out all the other great podcasts that we have. Keep checking the website for the latest E3 coverage, of which there will be a lot in the next week before the show.
Oh, boy.
And we have to start getting ready for E3. But we will be back next week with one last episode before the big show.
Before chaos reigns supreme.
Yes, we'll probably catch up on even more of your mail. And I don't know what else. So look forward to that. Of course, thanks to John, James, and Greg for holding down the fort while I was on travel for the first part of this episode. And we will see you next time on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye-bye.
Later. Bye.
My favorite GoldenEye scenario is playing in the caves with proximity mines, because there's all these dark places where you can put them, and it's pretty much impossible to spot them. Mm-hmm. So you just walk out of a tunnel and bam, you know, and then the challenge is, if you're the predator in that case, it's finding a safe place where you can actually watch it happen and enjoy it.
Hey John, why are you playing Xbox right now?
What do you think I'm playing, buddy? Why are you playing Xbox right now?
I'm not playing nothing. You don't know what I'm doing. You don't know.
What?
I just booted up live just to check a menu option to see what the name of the stupid level was, and I saw John's logged in.
Of course.
Oh my God.
I'm playing Perfect Dark, brother.
Are you really?
Yeah, I am.
Yes. So another good one is Dark Sims with only throwing knives, but you fill out every slot in the loadout with throwing knives. So they're just everywhere. Yeah. And you'll just walk in there and there's just knives flying everywhere like it's a fucking juggling act. It's ridiculous. And there's nothing you can do. You're going to get cut into pieces, but they're like killing each other. Do it free-for-all style. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, we had the one match with knives, and that was just completely absurd. You're just sitting around, like, you know,
that was
switching
awful.
To poison knife, and you're like, wow, that still isn't really doing anything at all. It's not even really helping. And then you get killed by, like, three Sims that are both sitting there dual-wielding two freaking knives, holding them by the blades. This is ridiculous.
That was the funny thing, is I walked into a room, and there were three Sims staring at me, and they're all in the most ridiculous position, because they're all holding two knives by the blade. So the knives are just sticking up. So they're just holding them right in front of their face, and they just start flinging them at me. And I was like, it's like the birds, you know?
It's like, oh my god,
what did I just walk into?
They're staring at you with those dead eyes too, right?
Yeah. Like,
with that blank look on their faces, just kind of like
there was a split second where we could hear Johnny react to the fact he's suddenly being pelted with knives, and we realize there's not a damn thing we can do to save him. It's like, John, he's gone.
Yeah.
John's just gone.